Good evening, everybody. It's 7 o'clock. I'm going to start the meeting. I know there's still people coming in, but I guess it's going to be their loss or something like that, or our gain or something like that. This is actually a special meeting of Board of Supervisors. At all our meetings, we do pledge allegiance to the flag, so I'd ask everybody to please stand up and join me in a pledge allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
If you could remain standing, please. It's after the pledge. We always do a moment of silence. I'm doing a moment of silence for the men and women that protect this great nation, and I'm also including the families and the injured and those affected with our friends overseas with the recent activities. So join me in a moment of silence, including all of those I just mentioned. Our hearts go out to them, to their families, and to those that were lost. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. We have a monumental crowd here. Thank God the Phillies are on at 10 o'clock and nobody's going to watch them anyway. Let me explain what's going to happen tonight.
Get the microphone closer to your mouth.
Let me explain what's going to happen so everybody knows. We want to leave as much time as possible for questions and answers. We know there's going to be a ton of them. We have till 10:30 in the building, and we'll stay here as long as we have questions going at 10 o'clock to 10:30. What's going to happen is, and I'll introduce everybody in just a second, but what we're going to do is have the emergency services personnel that are in the township or in the county talk about their competencies with respect to handling incidences that may or may not occur on the pipeline. There has been a lot of conversation with us, but with people that are not quite sure what their capabilities are, what their training's been, and so forth and so on. So we thought it would be most effective tonight to let them explain all that to you so you get some level of comfort. After they do that, go through an exercise of an incident. It will be fairly quick, but it will show how they interact together so that people know what will happen in the event there's some kind of an incident that occurs on the pipeline. Following that, which should take around 45 minutes, the Sunoco reps can make whatever comments that they want to make. And at the end of that, then we'll open it up for questions, and I'll explain how that's going to work. I do need to ask, is there anybody in the audience that's recording the meeting? And if so, you need to come down, and you need to give us your name and address. Come on down. And I will tell everybody that we are also recording the meeting. Some have asked us to do that, and we're going to try to make sure that it gets onto the website, and hopefully that's doable. Just talk into the mic. Your name and address.
My name is Hugh Brownstone, and I'm at 39 Cobblestone Drive in Paoli.
Nice film. Yeah. Nice film.
Leo Sinclair, here in East Goshen.
Thank you, Leo. Hey, Leo, you want to give your street address, please?
Okay, sure. 217 North Lockwood Lane.
Thank you. Anybody else? As I mentioned, it'll be up. It's important for all of us up here to talk into the microphones, and I'll explain how we're going to handle the question and answer period when we get to that point. With that in mind, I want to introduce everybody that's up here. I'll start down at the end, way down on the end, is Dr. Bob Fleming. He's the Deputy Chief and Public Information Officer for the Goshen Fire Company. Next to him is Bill Turner. Bill's the Deputy Director of the Emergency Services Department of the county. Next to Bill is Don Erb. Don is the Deputy Chief of the Hazmat Team of Chester County. Next to Don is our Chief, Chief or Not. She's the Chief of our Police Department, the Wego Police Department. And last but not least is Supervisor Carmen Batavio, who is also our fire marshal. Now, what we're going to do is go in the order of those folks starting on the very left in just a second. There are still a few people coming in. That's great. I will tell you that for those that need to know, the restrooms are directly opposite that door over there. So if anybody feels the need, just pop right up and go there. There's water fountains out there, too, also. With that, I will turn the mic over to Dr. Bob, and he can talk about the capabilities of the Goshen Fire Company with respect to responding to an incident involving the pipeline.
Okay, good evening. We welcome the opportunity to be with you tonight and to talk about preparedness for hazmat emergencies within Chester County and specifically hazmat incidents that could involve the pipeline. It's important to realize as we look at this, we have lots of pipelines, we have lots of hazardous materials in the world around us in the township. And with that in mind, as we look at this, we're going to talk about preparedness to handle hazmat incidents. And part of that preparedness really involves handling the pipeline types of issues as well. I'm fortunate enough to have with me tonight three of my colleagues, two from Chester County Department of Emergency Services and our police chief. And as we go through, I'm going to lay a little bit of groundwork, and then they're going to fill in the pieces we haven't talked about. We're going to start out talking a little bit about what things look like if there was a possible emergency. We're going to talk about the capabilities each agency brings to the table. And then we're going to go back through a second time and talk about what would happen if there was a report of an incident involving the pipeline, just to share with you how that works. In starting out, it's important to point out that we all work together on a regular basis throughout the year. And many of us have worked for many years together. As well as the roles I play at Goshen Fire Company, I've had the opportunity to be chairman of emergency planning, the local emergency planning committee for Chester County for the past 25 years, and I've worked with these gentlemen in that regard. And basically, we take serious the importance of planning for, anticipating, and making sure we have all the resources in place to handle emergencies. If there were to be an emergency, you're going to find that there's going to be a response that will consist of multiple agencies coming together with different disciplines to handle the demands of a particular incident. It's also important to realize that every incident, no matter what it might be, if it was a fire in your house, if you had a traffic accident, every incident will be a unique incident. So if you were to say to us exactly how would you handle a particular incident, we really couldn't tell you that till we knew the specifics of the incident in a given day. But I'm here to tell you from the standpoint of Goshen Fire Company, we are prepared to handle these incidents. One of the things you'll hear from our hazmat deputy chief as we go through this is we are fortunate to have a hazmat team in Chester County that basically has been recognized, has been approved and certified by the state. It was the first hazmat team to be certified as having 100% of the members in the team certified to the hazmat technician level, which you'll hear about. And we're fortunate that the hazmat team runs out of the County Government Services Building. So with that in mind, a hazmat team in Pennsylvania has up to 2 hours to respond to an incident. That would never be the case in our situation because they're so close and readily available. A number of years ago, we put in place a dispatch protocol that basically was unique at that point in time. It's been adopted around the Commonwealth since then and other places. We called it our 14-point dispatch protocol. If it even sounds like when the dispatcher takes the call, if it even sounds like it could involve hazardous materials, automatically the hazmat team gets dispatched so we can get them on the road to get here quickly. So that's the way things work. From the standpoint of Goshen Fire Company, we bring the various resources necessary to get the job done. Obviously, we have two fire stations. We have one at Boot Road and Greenhill, and we also have one over on Park Avenue, the 1300 block of Park Avenue. Hopefully, many of you are familiar with the 1300 block of Park Avenue. That's where we do Goshen Fair each year, and you never really need to know the specific dates other than the fair always ends the first week of August. So we encourage you to come, support the fair, have a great time, and so forth in that regard. With that in mind, we have apparatus at both stations, and we have the right apparatus we need to get the job done based upon the dynamics, the challenges we face in the community. We have the equipment necessary to get the job done. And one of the things we've done in recent years is we've done a lot of work applying for grants to get additional equipment needed and so forth. And last but not least, one of the most important parts is we have the people. And in terms of the number of people, traditionally we started out as a volunteer fire department. Reality is that in this day and age, when you run 3,500, 3,600 ambulance calls a year and probably in a couple years it'll be 4,000 ambulance calls. We really supplement our volunteers with career staff. So we have 8 full-time career staff. We have 12 to 15 at any point in time part-time career staff. We have about 75 volunteer members. Every member we are going to bring with us to a hazmat incident will have the appropriate level of training. Basically, there's a number of levels of training. There's awareness training. All of our people have awareness level training. Beyond that, there's operational level training. We operate to the operational level in hazmat. Every member, when they come in, gets the initial training in hazmat awareness and operations. Each year, typically in January or February, they also get refresher training in that area. With that in mind, there are levels of training beyond that, generic types of training in hazmat. The level beyond that would be the technician level. We have people at Goshen, myself included, who are trained and certified to the technician level, but as a local fire department responding, we don't operate to that level, particularly when we have the hazmat team coming, which Don Herb will be telling you about and so forth in a few minutes. In addition to the training, we have our people always going to training courses at the various fire academies, the training conferences. A lot of the focus on those things will be on hazmat training. All of the new members going through basic firefighter training these days take hazmat training at the regional fire academies as part of that training. So the bottom line is we've had a lot of training. We've had a lot of experience relative to hazmat incidents. And beyond that, when you look at it, we also have had specific training in pipeline safety, handling pipeline emergencies and so forth, including some training that Sun made available a while back. Goshen actually hosted one of those training sessions, and I believe you're going to hear tonight about how they're making provision to bring in one of the top experts in the country in hazmat training, and basically he will be conducting some training sessions, and I will be telling you Goshen will be handling, hosting one of those training sessions. So the bottom line is we're here, we're prepared to do what we need to do to serve you, and we work together as partners in the collection of systems we have here as public safety. So with that in mind, talking about the capabilities part, let me turn things over to Bill Turner, who's Deputy Director of Emergency Management for Chester County Department of Emergency Services.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Just mentioned for all the people standing, there's a bunch of seats up here to my left if you guys want to fill in some of these seats here. There's quite a few over here. As mentioned, my name is Bill Turner with the Chester County Department of Emergency Services. I lead up the Emergency Management Division. We have 11 full-time staff that basically spend every day in Chester County ensuring that all 73 municipalities have plans in place and are prepared for any emergency or disaster, whether it be a pipeline emergency or a flood or a winter storm or utility outage. We take an all-hazards approach. I understand the topic here that we're talking about tonight is related to pipelines, but and what we do, we keep a focus on all hazards, and we do a lot of hazard vulnerability analysis of what could affect the county and what our threats and hazards are throughout the county, and spend the time to ensure that we're dedicating our resources and training to address and try to mitigate and prevent some of these things from happening. With that said, being from a Commonwealth, without trying to lecture anybody on how the government works and put everybody to sleep, I'll just mention that in the county role, we're really a coordinating entity. In Pennsylvania, every municipality has a local emergency management coordinator, local fire department, local police. The county is really not, in the terms of emergency services, necessarily a response organization. We support and assist the response effort on the local level. I mentioned at the last meeting that everything starts and ends on the local level in terms of disasters and emergencies. So it's really the local fire, police, and agencies that are responding initially. If an event were to grow beyond the capabilities of the local municipality, if there were unmet needs or they needed resource coordination or additional resources to respond, the county emergency management, through our watch officer program, would initiate some assistance to basically help the municipalities, basically bring the incident to a resolution and try to stop it from growing or expanding, whatever that may be, and then shift into a recovery mode to get everything back to normal. So as a county emergency management, we're not necessarily going to get involved. We don't necessarily have a jurisdiction per se. We would have to more or less be requested by, in this case, East Goshen Township to step in. We do a lot, as I mentioned, in terms of planning and preparedness. One of the things I didn't get to touch on last time was, and there's a bunch of these in the back, I'll just touch on two quick programs. Before I got here, I ran some numbers. So has anybody ever heard of Ready Chesco? This is basically where you sign up, readychesco.org, to get county emergency information, community information from your municipality, weather alerts, public health emergency information. I mean, you can go in there and sign up for a whole slew of really good information to receive to your email, your text, cell phones. It'll even call your home if you want it to. I ran some numbers before I got here, and only about 9% of East Goshen Township residents are signed up for this, so we'd really like to see that number go up and get more people enrolled. There's some on the back table there if anybody's interested in grabbing one of those. And the second piece of that is Smart 911. This is a newer platform that we launch. This isn't something that we would necessarily use to notify you, but what happens is you go in and create a profile for you, your family, your pets. It has some personal information that we keep safe and secure, and it also allows you to basically put in your medical history, what medicines you may be on, who in your family may have an access or functional need or a disability. And what this would come into play is that if you call 911, that dispatcher is now going to have all that safety profile information right at their fingertips to be able to get you the assistance that you need more quickly. And it's really going to help the job of the first responders. But in this case, it'll allow us during a potential incident such as a pipeline emergency to effectively basically draw on a map, a circle around an area, and know how many people, let's say, are in a wheelchair or may have mobility problems or need help getting out. So unless you go and voluntarily enroll for this, we're not going to have that information. So I encourage everybody to go and create a Smart 911 profile for their family and themselves as well. And the good thing about this is it travels with you. So any device you register, if you go to another county in Pennsylvania or anywhere in the nation that has this in their dispatch center, and you call from a registered device, that same information will pop up. So if you're on vacation somewhere, it would still work. I spent a lot of time saying that we're not a response organization. However, the hazmat team does fall under emergency management. It's a paid team. There's a full-time hazmat coordinator under emergency management, and then there's 29 part-time paid members that basically wouldn't be a response entity in this case. I'll take questions after this regarding what I just talked about, but I think it's a good segue to let Don talk more about the hazmat team. So.
Thank you, Bill. Good evening, everyone. From the hazmat team's perspective, we're going to bring some advanced capabilities to assist the local incident commander. Whoever the officer in charge is from Goshen Fire Company, they would be running the incident. Our primary role is to support them in what they need to bring the incident to a successful conclusion. This could be anything from if we're a tank truck type incident to actually stopping the leak, plugging leaks, patches, defensive actions like building dams or preventing the flow of product. In the case of a pipeline, it could be something doing air monitoring. We have very advanced air monitoring capabilities. We can set them up remotely to monitor a large area. We can feed that data to the incident commander to assist him in making decisions on where evacuation zones may need to be, what areas we're seeing product move to, where we're not seeing it move. So we can provide all kinds of high-level instrument capabilities above what the local fire company would have to supplement them. Our personnel are trained, as Bob said, to at least the technician level, which is over and above the operations. About 40% of our personnel are at the specialist level, which means they've undergone some type of advanced training over and above that, some type of specialty. 17 of our personnel have completed pipeline technician training. We're involved also with the training that Sunoco's done in the past. We're doing this constantly. We just had 5 members down in Baltimore 2 weeks ago at the International Hazmat Conference. One of the contacts down there was Greg Knoll, who's written most of the response agency books for hazardous materials. He's going to be doing additional training in the county, at least 2 classes. Been contracted by Sunoco to do that. This is never an ending process. We'll never feel that we are totally prepared for anything. We constantly evaluate, we constantly train, we look at our plans, we look at our capabilities. Every time we go out on an incident, it's just like a football game. You know, we do our own Monday morning quarterbacking. We get together after the response. We review our operations. What worked well? What worked in? What equipment do we need? What procedures do we need to change? So this is a constantly evolving, ongoing process where we're never going to say we're 100% prepared for everything. But we are trying. We are changing and adapting to the situations as they go on.
Chief?
Good evening, everybody. I'd like to build upon the basis of what my colleagues have laid out for you to let you know what the police department has prepared to respond to an incident such as this. Every officer in Pennsylvania is required to be certified. It's called Act 120 training. And with that training, there's requirement that you have a familiarity with the National Incident Management System, or the NIMS program, all hazard planning, and also hazardous material. All command staff at the police department has been trained up through level 900 of the NIMS training. Our traffic safety unit, which we have within the department, is responsible for responding to accidents that need to be reconstructed, and also they do commercial vehicle enforcement. As such, they have received additional hazmat training. Approximately 35% of our department members are also members of fire companies, which means that the training that my colleagues have talked about, our officers have also received that training. Every year, a police officer in Pennsylvania is also required to do annual updates. It's called Act 180 training. In the last 15 years, there have been 5 years, where there has been a focus on all hazard training, which would include hazmat training. One of the things that I want to point out that this county does very well, in fact, I think it's the best that I've seen. Prior to coming to this police department, I worked for the Pennsylvania State Police for 28 years, and during that time, I worked in 9 different counties. I can say that Chester County has the best trained, best equipped, and best coordinated response that I've seen in a county. And one of the things that Chester County particularly excels at is in all hazards planning and training. One of the things that I can say about Chester County, I do not know of another county in Pennsylvania that has active shooter training. That means if somebody were to go into a school or into a business and start shooting, everyone in Chester County as a police officer has received the same training, and we are all prepared to respond as a single unit. Recently, they had a mock shooter incident at the Collegium Charter School, and all of the agencies that are represented here tonight also participated in that exercise. And as Don indicated, it was a really great opportunity to do an assessment afterwards as to what went well and what didn't go well. Within the last year and a half, there was a hazmat crash mock exercise that was done at Cheney University. We've also had pandemic training within the last 5-7 years. And also, Chester County has several emergency response teams, which are some of you might call SWAT teams. They are trained, and they particularly train in high-risk incidents, and therefore they receive training in this area too. And with regard to Westtown East Goshen Regional Police Department being prepared to have enough police officers, the one thing that everybody has kind of touched on is there's things called mutual aid agreements. That means that if I needed more police officers, I could reach out to the surrounding police departments around our jurisdiction, and those agencies would provide officers. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, now you know why, at least I have said as a supervisor, that I feel comfortable. I'd like to give you a little information on the township role. Our charge as supervisors, we are responsible for the protection of the lives and property of East Goshen residents. I'm sorry for the ones that don't live in East Goshen. I would try to help you too if I could. East Goshen has an emergency operation plan that provides a framework for how an incident is managed. The framework utilizes the National Incident Management System, which you've heard the other departments way above us talk about. It's used by all emergency services providers, as you've heard, so that if an event happens, we're all working out of the same playbook. We all understand what's going on. Now, on East Goshen's part, in the event of a pipeline incident, and other disasters that could happen, such as hurricanes or whatever Mother Nature may throw at us, we work with our local fire companies and our county as needed. As a general rule, in the event of a pipeline incident, the fire chief or the incident commander will assume the role of the commander and overall control of what needs to be done. At that point, we in East Goshen have an emergency management coordinator and an assistant. Kevin Miller is our coordinating manager. He's worked in the Township Public Works for 10 years and is currently Deputy Fire Chief at West Whiteland Fire Company. So now you can see how everything is tying together with fire company, with training. He has 15 years of fire service, and his training includes National Firefighter 1, Vehicle Rescue, Emergency Pipeline Training. I could go on and on, but basically it's following what Don and Bill and Bob up at the end have talked about. Our assistant is Mike Holmes. He is our assistant emergency management coordinator, and he's worked for the township for 5 years. He's currently a lieutenant at West Whiteland Fire Company with 7 years of fire service, and his training includes, let's talk about it, National Firefighting 1 and 2, HAZMAT, National Incident Management Training Systems, and he has an associate degree in emergency management and planning. The emergency management coordinator will mobilize all of the resources and personnel as required. So the fire company is going to come to the township at some point on a hazard and say, East Goshen, we need help. We need transportation. So East Goshen, part of our job is transportation vehicles to relocate residents to a temporary location. Chief, if I smack you, I'm so sorry. I've got to have this arm movement here. We've got our Public Works Department, which is fully staffed with some of the equipment that they're talking about. We've got backhoes. We've got emergency trenching equipment. We have lots and lots of sand and salt and stuff if we need to use for barricades. Engineering, we have the engineering as the county or the incident command may need as far as water, sewage, road construction, and repairs so that we can sort of help them where needed on that. We would assist them with mass care, which is finding buildings where residents can be relocated on a temporary basis. We do have an entire list that the building owners and or management have been notified and agreed. The county also knows about it. They have the same playbook, back to what we're talking about. Resources support. This would be food and water temporarily for shelters. That we've now moved 700 people to, Bob, I'm going to use Goshen Fire Company. Until the Red Cross and other organizations can be there, our Public Works Department, under our Emergency Management Coordinator, including possibly the Board of Supervisors, could be responsible for helping to get some things that are needed to help the people have comfort. Public safety, if we need to, we might help the fire company or the fire police or the police with security and patrolling at the shelters. We don't have arresting powers, so we would be working under the police. They might say, we need four of your guys to stand out front just to make sure that something doesn't happen. Last but not least, we have agriculture would be our loved pets. If we have pet owners like myself and many other people, we would help to find a temporary structure and food or whatever for pets on a temporary basis until the SPCA or a professional organization can come in and take over. There's one last component that the five of us up here, Board of Supervisors, have the power to do when needed. If the event is serious enough, after meeting with all of the other incident commanders and the police chief and so forth, we have the legislative powers to declare a state of emergency. We would not do that until we talk to everybody, including probably that time the governor, possibly, who knows. but the supervisors, as the legislators of the township, would be the ones, along with everybody down here, that would call for a state of emergency. That's outlined in the PA Emergency Management Services Code. Very simply, it gives us authority to make some temporary changes. We can ask people to shelter in place. We can ask people not to go to work. We can shut down roads. There's a whole list that we can do until the state and other resources can come in through our friends up here and take care of us. Very simply, closing, East Goshen Township has the fine organization that Brenda was talking about as far as coordination and skills and the personnel required that I believe we feel comfortable constantly learning and training together that we could work out any situation that arises. Thank you.
Thank you, folks. I hope everybody has a sense that from the county through the township, there has been adequate, well, I shouldn't say adequate, there's been training, there's been certifications, they are prepared to handle any situation, although we're focusing on the pipeline situation tonight. I hope the people that felt that there may not have been some of that training that's important and some of those other classes that they've taken, I hope you realize going home tonight that these people are well equipped to handle a situation that crops up, and we'll get to some more of that a little bit later. But let me give them just a break for a second. I would like to introduce the rest of the folks up here at the head table, and I suspect a lot of people know, some of us, I suspect that most everybody in East Goshen knows our manager, Rick Smith. He's the champion of us all. And he was the one that put everything together tonight so everybody could hear us, which is a real challenge, I must admit. Next to Rick is Chuck Proctor, one of the supervisors, and then Janet Emanuel. And then last but not least over there is Mike Lynch. And I know John Ulster, our CFO, was supposed to be up here, but he's sitting down in a corner so nobody knows who he is. It's amazing when you sit up here, there's a lot of people. Your folks for staying on the wall, there are a fair number of seats, particularly in the middle, if you don't feel like standing. But I would say we're rapidly approaching 350 to 400 people in this room, which is kind of a heck of a turnout. I do recognize one person here from one of our elected officials' office, and I hate to do this because if there's somebody else here and I don't see it, I'm not going to know who it is. But I would like to introduce Courtney Eubanks, who's from Senator Killian's office. Courtney, just stand up for a second in case anybody in this room would love to ask you anything about any of this. Courtney is well-versed in the Sunoco situation, so she and Tommy Killian is our senator here in East Goshen, state senator, and he's very responsive to us, and we appreciate Courtney being here tonight. If there's anybody... Oh! Eleanor's, how are you?
Christina.
Yeah, Chris is there.
Chris,
does everybody know Chris Sappy? Stand up, Chris. I just assumed everybody knew you, Chris. I'm sorry. I didn't see you down there. Representative Carolyn Committee is our state rep, so we have at least a senator and a rep reported here tonight. We'll give you a grade A and a grade A, and that's a wonderful thing. Thank you very much. With that, now we're going to kind of run through this so that you understand what happens with emergency services and how all this links together if there's an incident. And I will ask Bill Turner to serve as the 911 receiver so that we can get the process started. And what I will do, I have determined that I'm in the executive center behind the gas station off Boot Road, and I happen to work there, which I don't, but for the purpose of this I do, and I happen to see some bubbles coming out of the ground. And having worked there, I know that the Sunoco pipeline is right underneath there and something just doesn't ring true. So I pick up the phone, I dial 911, and lo and behold, I get Bill Turner on the phone, and Bill, take over.
Okay, sure, I'll walk you through this, and just for the record, I'm not going to be the one picking up the phone, but we do have a large amount of full-time staff down in West Goshen at the Government Services Center. The 911 Communication Center falls under the Department of Emergency Services, and they're there 24/7, 365. A lot of dedicated individuals that you want to talk about behind the scenes that don't get a lot of credit. that aren't out necessarily in the front lines, but this is basically where everything starts, where that 911 call initiates. And we also, to mention, we do have an alternate center now in South Coatesville-Boro at the Public Safety Training Campus, which is also where a lot of this training we discussed takes place. It's a state-of-the-art facility. If you haven't been out there, I would highly recommend checking it out. You know, it's a little bit further out from where we're at now, but it's been a long time coming for Chester County to have a facility like that where our responders and everyone can basically train together. But anyway, back to the 911 call. The 911 call comes in and more or less initiates a protocol where very quickly, basically through our public safety radio system, paging system, and our what we call CAD, a computer-aided dispatching system, is going to initiate and follow certain protocols to get the fire company in this case, and potentially on how the call is taken, potentially the hazmat team as well in the initial response, and police and EMS headed to the scene. And basically that spark, as I call it, would ignite a whole series of events. And until, you know, basically the last person packs up and everything's cleaned up from whatever scene they're responding to, those 911 call takers and dispatchers are there throughout the whole entire process, coordinating and providing an overall situational awareness of what's going on with that incident. So I'll turn it over to Dr. Fleming for him to talk about what the fire company would do.
Yes, and an important point, earlier we mentioned mutual aid. It's important to realize there's a difference between what we call automatic aid and mutual aid. As I said before, we have a dispatch protocol that if in any way it could possibly be a hazmat incident, you're going to get the hazmat team and the initial dispatch. So mutual aid would be we get there and realize we need more resources. As Carmen was talking about, we call for those resources. But the good news is with automatic aid, the county will be dispatching Goshen Fire Company for the fire department, for the fire rescue hazmat piece, for EMS, emergency medical services, and also for fire police. And one thing I want to point out that I didn't talk about in the capabilities, we are very unique and blessed at Goshen to have a fire police division that at any point in time has 20 to 25 members in the fire police division. As an incident commander running an incident, I could count on at any time, day or night, at least half a dozen or more fire police being there even for a routine incident. And as we talk about some of the things that may be necessary in an incident, if we talk about doing evacuations, if we talk about doing traffic control, having the fire police involved will be very important in that regard. So basically, we've been dispatched from Goshen, the hazmat team has been dispatched from the county, and WEO has been dispatched for law enforcement. So we all respond to the incident. In all likelihood, police will get there first or fire will get there first. Whoever gets there first will size up the incident and know what we're dealing with. And several of my colleagues talked about the National Incident Management System, NIMS. That was actually invented or reconstituted after September 11, 2001. But we in the fire service have had an incident command system that served as the basis of that for over 30 years. So basically, everyone coming will be trained to the appropriate levels in NIMS. We will know how the system works. As part of that system, there will be someone assume responsibility to manage that incident. That person is referred to as the incident commander. So assuming I were the senior fire officer showing up from Goshen Fire Company on a given day, my responsibilities would be to size up the incident and figure out exactly what's going on here, what do we need to do to deal with this incident. And with that in mind, the size up would be what we know ahead of time through pre-planning types of activities. The information we're getting from the dispatchers, we're responding to the incident. We have access to the CAD system to pull up information from the CAD, and plus the dispatcher will be feeding us information. And it's important to realize, while there are a number of people working in the dispatch center, for something like this, there will be a dispatcher that will take responsibility and take ownership for our incident. So they're not only handling the communication piece on our behalf, but they're really overseeing the incident and knowing what we need and making sure we have all the resources we need for the incident. So the incident commander arrives, sizes up what he or she is dealing with, establishes what we call command, and basically operates under three priorities. No matter what incident we're talking about, the three priorities are always going to be: the number one priority is life safety, number two is incident stabilization, and number three is property conservation. So based upon that, the size up will include determining what has happened here, what is currently happening, what's likely to happen next, and then basically we're going to establish strategic goals. What do we want to have happen here from this point forward to make this a successful outcome? We're going to figure out the tactics we need to engage in to make that happen. We're going to figure out the resource needs we have. And if we need to call for additional resources, we will call for those additional resources. Now, typically every incident is going to have a single incident commander. Certain incidents, perhaps this pipeline incident will be one of those incidents, it may not be, could actually be operated under what we call a unified command. And that would be where two senior people, one from two different agencies, work together and manage the incident. And as an example, if I were managing this incident, if I were the incident commander for the incident, if we had to engage in doing evacuation, I would be finding the senior law enforcement person there and saying, will you be my partner and work together with me in running this command? And basically then we have a system in place. For example, if we were doing evacuation, if we were doing traffic control, the law enforcement community would play a major role in that. They would call for additional resources they need. They would utilize and work with our fire police and so forth. So the reality is we're going to figure out what the incident is. We're going to figure out what the needs of the incident would be. You've heard about evacuation. There's something we call evacuation. There's also something we call shelter in place. And with that in mind, sometimes it makes sense in an incident to just shelter people in place throughout the incident. Sometimes it makes sense to evacuate people and move them someplace else. That moving them someplace else could be, for example, coming to Goshen Fire Company. Carmen mentioned 700 people. We do have a hall, a very nice hall available for rental. Holds up to 160 people. Feel free to call upon us to rent our hall. But with that in mind, there's a difference between what we call going to a conference center and what we call an actual shelter. So in all probability, we might move people to places like Goshen and churches and so forth early on just to put them in a conference center to get them out of danger. But with that in mind, if we needed to house people for a period of time, then we would be working with the Red Cross to actually set up the shelters with the food, the cots and so forth, they need to be able to do that. And we've rehearsed these things. We know how these things work and so forth in that regard. And that's basically the way the process would work. And typically, we'd be at the incident scene managing things. We'd be working with the township. We'd be working with the emergency management coordinator. We'd be identifying the needs we have and so forth. And for that matter, we would also be working with the pipeline owner. We'd be working, for example, with the Sunoco pipeline with the people from Sunoco. And everybody I've just described, including the people from a pipeline company, have been trained, as we have been trained, know the incident command system, and we would all work together in a cohesive system. So that's what the fire department would be doing in that regard. Let me pass it on. Anything that you want to cover before turning it over to Don?
Sure. I'll just touch on one more thing. One of the big things that's going to be going on again behind the scenes also, which is very important in any incident, is what we call public information. And that's keeping everybody informed. That's whether it's the responders on scene or the public informed of what's going on, getting them timely information that they can use to make an intelligent decision, and make sure that they have instructions and know clearly what they need to do, whether it's a shelter-in-place order, it's an evacuation. In Pennsylvania, you know, only really the governor has the authority to issue or compel evacuation, but the reality is we can't really force anybody out of their home, but we would hope that you would listen to the instructions from your local officials. But what we would be doing, as I mentioned before, through Ready Chesco, and what we have also reverse 911, we would be putting messaging out. Ready Chesco is voluntary, so if you're in there, you'll get it. If not, we have what we call basically white and yellow page data from the telephone companies that we can reverse call your landline if anybody still has a landline in the residence. We're seeing those numbers go down of landlines, but we still have the capability to, whether you sign up or not, reach out to your landline and get you that public information or emergency communications that you might need to act upon. So turn it over to Don from here.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. I feel a little left out. I don't have anything to plug here or advertise. Our job in looking at from the overall standpoint is actually pretty easy. Our function is to support the incident commander in whatever he needs. Our personnel would come and would staff up what we refer to as the HAZMAT branch of the incident command system. So our primary focus is the hazard itself. What's the problem itself? How can we eliminate or stop that problem? We're going to do this, you know, like I said earlier, it could be stopping the leak. It could be plugging stuff. It could be, you know, shutting off valves if necessary, depending on what the issue is. We're also going to bring the monitoring capability there. We're going to feed a lot of data to the incident commander. the information he's going to use to make decisions on, you know, where we need to shelter in place, where we need to be concerned in that, is going to come up through the HAZMAT branch to him. We also have the capability to pull in mutual aid assets for HAZMAT teams. The five Philadelphia area counties, their HAZMAT teams have been working together since 1998, when the planning started for the 2000 Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. So even prior to 9/11, we've been working together. The team leaders meet on a regular basis. We also go and we train on a regular basis as regional teams. So we're familiar with each other. Basically, they're a phone call away. A lot of our information that we're going to supplement what the fire company has. The fire company has basic meters in that to do flammable gases, to do oxygen levels, to do carbon monoxide levels and that. We're going to bring meters with a little more advanced capabilities. We're going to bring the capability to network these things together so we don't have to have a firefighter tied up standing somewhere on a street corner monitoring. We can just set a meter there and look at it remotely on a laptop computer. Basically, we're going to feed up, and whatever the incident commander needs to make that particular issue go away, we're going to be the go-to guys. We're more or less the HAZMAT SWAT team, if you want to think of it, and that's the role we're going to fill. Well, the incident commander's looking at the big picture, what's going on, what areas do I need to evacuate, what's going on outside that immediate problem. We're going to be very focused on the problem itself and making that go away and help it go better. Chief?
If there were a pipeline emergency, the police department would primarily be in a support mode for the fire company. Primarily, we would work with them to determine what the perimeter is. That's the area where they don't want anybody going in from that area. For example, they might say that there's a one-mile perimeter. We would establish the one-mile perimeter and make sure that individuals who don't need to come into the scene are kept away from the scene. Additionally, anybody who was trying to exit from the scene, we would give them assistance. One of the things that's really important for us to do to work with the incident commander is to determine access points. We're going to have a lot of resources coming in that involve emergency responders, so we're going to have to work with the incident commander to determine what roads he wants us to keep primarily clear so that they can respond, as well as those routes they'd like us to use for evacuation of citizens.
Our incident commander, our national guys, are just going to do what they want us to do. If they need our backhoes, we have backhoes. If they need staff, we'll get what staff we can. Any support they need from the Board of Supervisors, we will make sure that they have any authorities they need. We're an asset to them in this case.
There's one organization that we haven't mentioned with respect to what happens when there's an incident, and this gives me the opportunity to introduce the two folks from Sunoco Pipeline. I'm almost afraid to say it anymore. Joe McGinn and Charlie Stewart. Charlie is the pipeline operations director. And Joe's the senior customer service rep, I call him. He's got a better title than that, but that's what I like to call him. There is one thing that happens when 911 is called, and it involves a Sunoco pipeline. In addition to all the people that they've already notified, they also notify Sunoco. And I don't know if Charlie or Joe wants to answer the question, but I'd like them to explain what Sunoco does in case there's some kind of a problem with their pipeline.
Well, good evening, everybody. I appreciate you inviting us here tonight. What I'm about to say is probably going to add on to something you've already heard for the last 30 minutes or so, and that is basically incident command. So when an incident is identified, whether it's identified in our main control center in Reading, Pennsylvania, or it's identified by a landowner, property owner in the community, a number of things start to happen. Well, certainly a 911 call is made, and that initiates everything. That initiates everything you've already just heard, so I won't bore you with those details. On the pipeline side, what we then initiate is an emergency response. Whether it's us, another pipeline in the community, whether it's a leaking gas tank in a gas station, doesn't matter. We give 100% response with our people, Our incident command trained people, of which I'm one. I would be what you would call, if that was our response or was our release, we would be what you'd call the RP, responsible person for that event. When we get here, we get people out here, we send them out as quickly as we can. We basically call an all hands to get everybody to the location that was identified by the local police department or the landowner in case we're first. I don't think we will be in something like that. But we get out here and talk to the landowner, talk to the police officer, and basically get a review of what's happening, where is it at, what is it? Do we know if it's a gasoline, a furnace oil, a heating oil, a kerosene? Or in this new day and age, is it some type of NGL, natural gas liquids? Something bubbling out of the ground could be anything. We won't know. But as you heard the ladies and gentlemen speak here, they have air monitors, so they could identify pretty quickly what it is. So when we start responding, we'll get here and we'll set up, along with the local emergency responders, an incident command structure. And basically when it comes to that, I'll say this because I know that's the most important thing. I know you guys and ladies have a lot of questions for us. But the first thing we do is make sure we support the local police and fire department. From my perspective as an incident commander for Sunoco for 37 or so years approximately, the first thing I want to make sure is I know, to be honest, that we're going to fix the pipe eventually. If it is us and there's something wrong with it, we'll get to it. We know that. We have the people, the expertise to take care of that. So the first thing I would do if I was working with the local emergency response officials is what can we do to safe up the area and serve the community that is in the surrounding area? And you've heard a bunch of those things, whether it's to a hall or evacuate the area. I'd refer or basically reflect to the local police and fire officials, what do you want to do? We know there's a problem here. It looks like it is us. So now what can we do to help safe up the community and the area? We'll do hot zones, which you heard about. We'll tape it off. We'll get the wind direction. We'll do all those things that are in the plans that you heard. So basically from a pipeline response perspective, honestly, we're not even worried about the pipe at that time. We'll figure out what happened. We'll figure out how we repair it. We'll figure out how we get to it. I would function more than likely as some support to the incident command here at the table. And basically, whatever questions they had of us, they'd work it through me. I would work it through our people at the table. What's the product? What's the temperature? What's the composition of the product? You know, how much do we think may have been released? All those type of things I would work out and supply that information back to the local head in charge or the local incident commander. More than likely, for something like this that you're talking about for this example, they would set up unified command as soon as they saw that. And then what we would do, we would be the RP incident commander. So I would basically represent Sunoco Pipeline and basically take responsibility for the event, which means that anything that comes from that, any costs associated with that, reimbursement, community involvement, community evacuations, whatever it is, always is taken care of by the responsible party. That would be us. So in this case, we'd also work with the control center to try to determine some type of volume and make sure we understand exactly where it's going, where it went. You have to take into consideration sewer. You have to sewer drains, water inlets, creeks. How fast did it get to the creek? Did it get in the creek? How far down is it? Whatever it may be, if it's a liquid, if it's an NGL, it's a little different. On the Mariner system, it's a little different. So you have different type of issues that you have to deal with. So once we get that determined, first thing I'm sure the incident commander would tell me is, how far did it get, and are there any downstream communities that could be impacted by this liquid release? That would be all the things that we would do based on whatever else the incident commander wants of us. And so really, as they all described it right on, I'm picturing it in my mind, it's not me there saying, well, this is what we need to do to fix the pipe. This is what we need to do to dig up the pipe. At that stage, that's not even on the table. The most important thing is the community, how we're handling it. I refer to them and what they want to do, how they want to do it, and how can we help them do it. And at that point, as the incident evolves, there's a number of things. As all these ladies and gentlemen know, we identify objectives under incident command and NIMS. What are the goals and objectives? Everybody's got goals and objectives you want to achieve in your life, on the job, whatever it is. Normally, there's three or four
objectives we want to take care of, and first and foremost is the safety of the community. That's usually the number one. No matter where you go, no matter what it is, that's number one. And then there'll be a plan, operations, logistics, resources, all those things will work toward that goal. And it's our job to tell the incident commander that we're working toward accomplishing that objective. Down the road, after the first couple hours, then we come back into, they would probably ask me, what's your plan on excavating the pipe? At that time, I would have people who are trained in excavating and have a plan ready to go that I could hand to the incident commander and say, when the air settles and the area is safe, in conjunction with their health and safety officer, we'd have a safety plan. And then he would bless it, he or she would bless it and say, you can start digging at 2200 tonight once the area is safed up. And then that whole begins our real involvement. So you have the emergency response involvement up front, hot and heavy. Pipeline responds, but we're really supporting that initiative, that objective. And at some point, when the emergency starts to dwindle, health and safety is okay. There may be evacuations wherever you're at. That's something that our company would take care of, especially if we're responsible. We'd work with the township, get hotels, food, you know, vouchers, whatever it takes to take care of this incident and this event.
Airline tickets?
Airline tickets if you need. I probably need the airline ticket. I'm not sure about you. But so at that point, what we do is you'll see this happen. And no matter what the incident is, that's what happens. The emergency response starts to dwindle, and then the pipeline repair, remediation, restoration begins. And that could be properties, it could be damaged, gasoline-soaked sides of the creek, you name it. And then, so we have a group that handles that also. And that would all be part of the planning, restoration, health and safety of the community, whether they come back if they were evacuated, all those type of things. So really from a pipeline perspective, that's exactly what we do. That's kind of condensed. But fundamentally, we do this. We'll support every way we can, anything we can, and then eventually they'll look to us for that. We may even take over the incident as far as incident command once the emergency response phase goes. All depends on how it's set up.
And Charlie, just to add, because you're talking about the emergency response side, do you want to touch on kind of the pipeliners, you know, where folks are and how they respond, as well as the other piece that we do in the control room and our ability to lock in the system?
Yeah, one of the things, and I apologize, there's a lot of details go into it. I mean, if I'm called as an incident commander in this general area, which I would be, one of the first things we do is make sure the valves are closed on both sides of the leak site, and that basically minimizes anything that could be released. They're a couple miles apart. In our new system, they're automated. In the older system, they're not. So we have to get people out there. That'd be the first question. I heard one of the chiefs say, did you cut the source off? Very important. Absolutely. That's the first thing we do is shut every line down in the vicinity, whether it's the A line, the B line, the C line, it doesn't matter. If there's other pipelines in the vicinity, we'll ask them to shut down so that we can say we stopped the flow, but maybe there's still something coming out of the pipe because you still have some pressure depending on the elevation and the locations that you're at. So just because the line's down or just because the valves are closed, that doesn't mean that something's still not coming out of the pipe. And that's what we would address in the safety plan, whether the area is safe to dig up, you have to dig it up by hand, any respirators, whatever it may be. All those things are taken into consideration. And the first responders from the pipeline side, that's what a couple of those people would be doing. They're the pipeliners that Joe has referenced. They'll close the valves in. And at that point, we'd end up meeting with the chiefs, the police department. Where are we? What do you got? They'd set up an incident command center. We'd work out of that. And then really from there, it just escalates. People, resources, you name it. Everything starts coming together. But we do the same thing. We work under NIMS and incident command. Done it for a lot of years. And we know our place. You know, it's the first thing. If it's us, we know what we got to do. We know how to do it. And make sure we follow the orders of the incident commander until we run out of our objectives and we close it out and go home. And that doesn't happen overnight, as you could imagine. So that's kind of a general idea of what the pipeline does when we first get the call.
I want to thank everybody up at the table for doing what they did. A great job explaining things. They also did it within the timeline, which is really important because I know you people want to ask questions. When I talked to Joe McGinn about coming over here, Sunoco's had, you know, sometimes they want, sometimes they don't, but they decided to come because it's really important to our folks, and we've in East Goshen have had obviously the bulk of what's happened in this neck of the woods occur right on Paley Pike and 352. And Joe was very gracious to decide to come tonight and give their side of the story. I would say that the vast majority of the people in this room have probably heard at some point the information that has been circulated regarding the Pipeline Coalition. And it's in some cases, it's a little scary. And Joe's aware of that. So I said to them, why don't you come, make your case, let the people decide the level of comfort they have or don't have, and make some introductory comments, because you know there's some things that probably everybody in this room wants to know about. And I said, but don't take too long doing it, because the people are going to want to answer or ask questions, have answers to those questions. Some may have questions for the folks at the table, and that's fine too. Questions is the best way to find out answers. So with that, I would ask Joe to make some introductory comments, at which point we will then go into the questioning period, and I will explain how that's going to work when Joe's done.
Thanks, Marty. And thanks, everybody, for the opportunity tonight to address kind of questions and talk a little bit about our operations, our emergency response, and the current construction and plans for Mariner East 2 in East Goshen. You know, I know there's lots of questions, and there's varying levels in terms of awareness in the audience. There's some folks I see that have been at meetings with us before. Some folks, you know, may have been here, and it may be ones that I wasn't or not. So I'm just going to try to cover a few basics and do it in a concise frame to leave plenty of time for questions, because certainly, you know, respect your time and interest in coming out on an evening like this. You know, as we look at, you know, Mariner East, essentially, you know, what is it and what is operational in your community from Sunoco right now on the Mariner system? There's a 8-inch pipeline we refer to as Mariner East 1 that went into service in late 2014 and moves propane and ethane across the state to Marcus Hook, Pennsylvania, right in the southeast tip of the state. Mariner East 2 is what's under construction now, as so many folks are familiar with. And a key emphasis is it's Mariner East 2 is two pipelines, a 20-inch pipeline and a 16-inch pipeline. Be happy to address some specifics in construction, but again, you know, trying to give people time to have some questions. In terms of the review and approval of Mariner East 2, is approved by a varying level of organizations at the federal level and has guidance from organizations like the Army Corps of Engineers on a lot of environmental type issues, to the Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration. You'll hear folks refer to that as PHMSA. That's a federal regulator, to the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission on a state safety side, to the County Conservation District on a Chester County side from environmental, as well as engagement with the township. And a couple things on that. So both PHMSA and PUC, since the focus of tonight, I think in a lot of questions, is on safety, of construction and operations. They've had inspectors focused on this project. I don't know what else is in their portfolio, so I don't want to say exclusively, but on a daily basis, including doing audits all across the state. And I also would say, in terms of from a township perspective, the township and Rick Smith is somebody that, you know, leads and manages the township on a daily basis, and others in the township are constantly engaging and reaching out with questions or concerns that come from, you know, residents to us, to our construction team and, land team and other teams that are assembled. Ultimately, you know, the products that we're moving on the system are natural gas liquids. They also are referred to as liquefied petroleum gases, or LPGs. If you look at our pipeline markers that go along Boot Road for what is the 8-inch line, you'll see that, on the marker references that. The ethane, just quickly in terms of what it's used for, ethane is primarily used in the plastics industry. This plastic bottle, the malleable bottom part, is essentially made from ethane, as are a number of other products that we use on a daily basis. Ethane is also And part of the system we'll use it to burn. A new power plant out in the Johnstown region is building their power plant to use natural gas and ethane. Propane, again, is used in plastics. Some folks are familiar with Braskem that know the region and industry. They make polypropylene, which is essentially what goes into the cap of this bottle, a thicker, more durable plastic, things that go into cars, that make them more fuel efficient, lighter, et cetera. It's also a home heating fuel. I think there's about 80,000 folks in Pennsylvania use propane for home heat. It's also a big big use in the farming industry, both for drying crops as well as, for heating chicken, livestock, et cetera. And it certainly, as you get into more rural areas of the state, less densely populated areas of Chester County, propane is used for home heat. Butane is one that some folks are less familiar with in terms of big, people think of the lighters. But the primary use for butane is actually in the gasoline that we all use. In general, there's a summer blend and a winter blend of gasoline, and it varies a little bit with a lot of different components. But essentially for the, for winter blend gasoline, for example, butane is about 10% of the gasoline we use. So ultimately, when it comes across the state, we have a refined product system that Charlie also operates that it's distributed out and blended in there. So you have local opportunities as well as exports that have been addressed as well in terms of for markets beyond Pennsylvania, just because right now the current use is more than what we have after, the abundance that is the Marcellus and Utica shale in terms of how much product is there. In terms of, getting into some of the questions that folks have and trying to touch them head on, some folks have tried to say that Mariner East 2 is not a regular gas line or something different. It's a correct in an extent. It's classified differently than natural gas or methane. It's a natural gas liquids pipeline. And in terms of, being the first of its kind, that's also not accurate. There's 67,000 miles of natural gas pipelines in the U.S. and more than 200,000 miles of liquid pipelines altogether, things that move things like jet fuel, gasoline, et cetera. And if you look at the safety statistics for liquid lines, you'll find, getting into the part where I realize that folks are scared and have questions and for some things that were presented, but you'll find very few injuries or deaths. In the last 20 years, for all operators of liquid pipelines in Pennsylvania, for example, which Mariner East 1 would be one, there have been no deaths resulting from pipeline releases and two injuries. The other piece that I'll add in terms of liquid lines is, in addition to Mariner East 1, there's another one that's run through Chester County for decades. It's called the TEFCO system. It doesn't run through East Goshen. It runs through a lot of the same communities that Mariner East does and runs right through the heart of West Goshen and Westtown. Again, move product safely for plenty of years. The other kind of question and folks that hit on in terms of these natural gas liquid lines, being more dangerous than natural gas lines since, there's this familiarity because you have lines like Transco that run in towns like East Goshen and have for years. But the statistics just don't bear it out. In the last 20 years, 15 people died in accidents involving natural gas liquid lines. And at the same time, more than 300 people died in natural gas-related incidents. The key on the natural gas side is that, while that's not what we operate, most of these are related to the old unregulated distribution lines. Including ones like, in the city of Philadelphia with the PGW lines that are made of cast iron and have been in the ground without all of the safety inspections and things that we go through for decades. The other question that gets into in terms of the fear or things of anything new like this is, the likelihood. Folks talk about it as probability, and people have tried to imply that it's high. And that's just also not true, and the stats don't bear it out. The Department of Transportation and others, continue to document that pipelines are the safest mode of transporting these products. So just for example, in 2014, there were over 16 billion barrels of crude oil and products were delivered by pipeline. 99.9999% of those products reached their destination safely. And in terms of another piece that gets into folks looking at a leak versus a rupture, as well as our history, and just trying to address it and tackle it head on in terms of safety statistics, that, you know, leaks, when they do happen, tend to be small, and there's many layers of safety that prevent this a rupture scenario that some folks have tried to portray as inevitable. If you look at the national statistics for NGL lines, the scenario just doesn't happen. Even one death as a result of an NGL pipeline release is rare. In terms of our own pipelines, you know, we've been operating in Pennsylvania, in East Goshen Township, throughout for more than 80 years, and we routinely pass regulatory inspections. When you look at ultimately, okay, our safety record and so some things that folks have brought up. So when you look at our 10-year safety record and the number of incidents, a key thing to understand is 70% of those incidents were on our facilities, meaning they were in places like terminals and in facilities and properties that we own, as opposed to on a mainline pipe or a valve or something like that. And of those 70%, 90% are essentially contained to the facility. They don't leave the fence line. Other remaining pipeline incidents, you know, most of those involved our old system of crude lines in Texas and Oklahoma, which are sparingly used, so it leads to additional integrity challenges of using them, as well as the difference in a crude oil product, which will often have water in it, that can lead to internal corrosion on pipelines versus the NGL lines that will be used continuously. We just haven't had these same issues with our refined products lines, and that includes the Mariner ones. So I promised that I wouldn't speak too long, so I want to wrap it up to give time for questions, and tried to focus on, and I know there's going to be other questions, but on emergency response, some of the questions that were on that, some of the safety statistics, questions that I know folks in the audience, if you've heard some of the things that are said about us, wanted answered. So I try to do my best to quickly address that, and I'm sure there'll be other questions on it. And, ultimately, any questions that we have, you know, please let us know. And one last thing, in terms of meetings like this, because you have them, and I don't want to forget to mention this. So one of the things that we've done as well is for really anyone, but the primary target audience are folks that, you know, live along the pipeline route in East Goshen, you know, West Goshen, Westtown, wherever folks are at from tonight, is communication. So we have essentially a 24/7 toll-free hotline. The folks, it's picked up live by folks that work for us not too far away from here in Delaware County. And that number, it's on a bunch of materials, but it's 855-430-4491. And any materials in the back that's there, get the information and do our best to communicate that out. And the other thing, obviously, and many of you know, with folks like Rick Smith and reaching out to him, he is, or anybody in the township, they're always good in terms of putting those questions back to us, whether it's anything from, you know, what's the construction going on here to, can you tell us about, you know, who regulates you to anything else. So with that, I'll turn it back to Marty, and thank you guys for the time tonight.
I appreciate you making those comments. I hope some of them were helpful. There's a couple of things I want to say before we open it up to questions, and we're right about where we wanted to be. We'll be here to 10:30 if there's enough questions. But let me say first that every meeting that we've had, both here and in the township building, our residents have been most respectful of one another, the people that have been up here answering questions, and so forth and so on. It's important tonight that we use that same decorum. It's not easy sometimes for these folks to answer questions. Other times it is. Sometimes they know the answers and sometimes they don't. Hopefully you will get the answers to the questions that you have, and I know there's many of them out there. So let's be respectful of one another. And what we're going to do, can East Goshen people raise their hand for a second? I just want to see how many people. Oh, goodness gracious, it's not going to be a problem. My God, there's nobody home in East Goshen tonight. What we're going to do, this mic is on, have three people come up at a time, and when you come up, it's very important, because we have to put it in the minutes, to clearly state your name and street address, because we incorporate that into the minutes. If, in fact, all the East Goshen people exhaust questions before 10:30. We will then open it up to residents and other communities if there are any questions. The board has the opportunity to get information from Sunoco, from Rick, if we need to. So we've agreed tonight to not go first like we usually do and open the floor up to questions. So if there are three people who aren't afraid to come up and be the first three, you're welcome to come up to the microphone. And here's one coming, two coming, three coming. Okay. You guys can all fight for who wants to be first. You might all want to get, well, it'd be better if you were three at a time, but that's all right. If you get in line, so we make that transfer from one to the other pretty quickly. Dave, you want to give your name and address, and we get going here?
Yeah. David Shuey, 1547 Mill Race Lane.
Wait a minute. That might not, see if the mic's on.
Yeah, it's on. The volume's not up. How's that? David Shuey, 1547 Millrace Lane, East Goshen. And I'm going to talk a little bit about things I've heard. Joe and Charlie, thank you for being here tonight. So please correct me if any of my information is incorrect. I want to talk first about Mariner 1. And my understanding is you said it was commissioned in 2014, but it was repurposed in 2014. The pipeline is actually over 80 years old. When you repurposed that line was tested with two inline tools plus hydrostatically tested and detected no corrosion and no deficiencies. And then in Morgantown, it leaked. So I guess my question is that the two new pipelines are going to have newer detection and automated valves and those kinds of things. Since Morgantown, what have you guys done to retrofit Mariner 1 to first detect leaks? Because corrosion, I'm understanding, is the number one cause of leaks and ruptures. And that's an 80-year-old pipeline that now has pressurized liquid in it. What's been done to that pipeline to make it safer as it runs, say, 50 yards away from Wellington Senior Living Community?
So addressing the question in terms of for Mariner East 1. So for the incident that was addressed, just for some folks that aren't familiar with it, so we had a pipeline release of 20 barrels in essentially eastern Berks County a couple months back. Charlie was one of the folks that led the incident response. Essentially, you had what was a pinhole leak. So we have a number of detection systems that look for, again, it's all about risk. So as we look at a rupture, a catastrophic leak, there's things that will pick that up as our pipelines measure pressure, temperature, and flow. A leak like that was noticed by the landowner, reported in a similar scenario. Folks responded, locked in the system, and in terms of the impact with folks with monitors, at the level it was, and like I said, it was reported as a 20-barrel leak. Those detectors, really at the surface, were essentially non-detect in terms of, a flammable amount or dangerous amount in terms of any, hazard to public safety. So that's the background, just to make sure folks understand the incident that was referred to. So what's done there, in addition to what's done before the line, is you have a number of repairs, things that are looked at. While the line and the service goes back over about 80 years, there are a number of integrity digs that were looked at and done in advance of the pipe going into service. In addition, when it was repaired, you addressed the incident that we had and worked with a safety plan with PHMSA in terms of the restoring the line and the service and addressing other questions. I believe, and I don't know, Charlie, if you know better than me, that they're still pursuing with the investigation and identifying any further
It was Dave, right? David. In regards to Morgantown, as Joe said, I was out there and answered to your question, what are they doing moving forward? It was really a pinhole leak. It took us a while to dig it up and find it. And it was close to a weld. And that's what took us a while to get it, to make sure. And so what we did after that, As Joe mentioned, FEMSA DOT was there on site. They were also part of our incident command under the unified command. And PAPUC was there. And I can assure you, as these things happen, that as like the local government, they hold us accountable, as they should. And they had a lot of questions. How can that happen if you have protection on the pipe? I'm not a corrosion person, so you have to excuse me on that. I could certainly get some more specific answers for you. But I could tell you that what happened is they look at that pipe, the experts, along with DOT and PUC, and they'll go back and look at, they'll take all types of readings without getting too complicated, and then they cut that section out. And I'll say cut that section, and maybe the incident was here, but they may cut out 30, 40 feet on each side. And they'll cut that out, they wrap it up. The words I use now, it's almost like a crime scene. And to protect it, to make sure that somebody doesn't bump it, and that bump doesn't look like, well, you got hit 20 years ago, you didn't know it. All those things are taken back, they're taken to a third-party independent lab, and that's when our integrity group, which is not here tonight, they look at, they work with that third-party independent, that independent shares the information with DOT and PUC, and then at that point they'll come back with recommendations to what happened. And they could go back to mil specs on pipe or whatever it may be. So from that point, when that data comes back, I don't know if it's back yet, it wasn't that long ago per se, because it takes a long time. With the independent lab, there's no time frame on it. When that comes back, there'll be recommendations. And at that point, the integrity group, the corrosion group, because you're right, absolutely right, Dave, the rust is, I call it rust, the corrosion is critical. They'll address that and figure out, why did that happen? Why did it find that weak spot to go to that point? So I don't have the steps that they're moving forward on that, but they do come back. And then at that point, one other thing, they'll look at information on all those tools that you mentioned, and they'll see if there's anything similar on that line segment and any other line segment they have. And then they'll go in and do what you ladies and gentlemen probably hear, integrity digs. They'll go into a facility, or pardon me, a neighborhood, a community, a farm, dig it up, even if it's something similar or a similar type of reading that it may have at one time, and they'll do their type of repairs, replacements, or whatever they call it. So that's the process for some type of learning and figuring out what happened and how you get better.
I would add, in 1997, Sunoco replaced both pipelines in East Coast, well, part of West Coast, from Green Hill Road to the Sunoco station at Paley Pike. They replaced both lines, open cut. 2001, they came back and went from the Sunoco station at Paley Pike down to a little past Manly Road. So the pipes in East Coast are 1997 and 2001. The old lines were abandoned in place. Now, I don't know, maybe Joe probably wasn't around there yet, but it's one of the advantages of being old.
I'm Lex Pavlo. I live at 611 South Speakman Lane. I first of all want to thank the board. I've just sort of got my feet wet as I'm right on the pipeline highway of Boot Road and 352, so I've kind of had to start figuring out the impact and try and learn as best I can. So, been to a number of township meetings. I'm, with all due respect, I don't think it was gracious of the Sunoco people to come. I think they should be here, by the way. And as of a week ago, a week ago, they apparently weren't going to be here. So thank you for carving out the time. This is our community. We'd like to have some support given the fact that it's our backyards that are involved. With regard to the emergency management folk, this is awesome. You guys are great. A little bit more comforting from where I sit to hear the individuals on that end of the table. Thank you for taking the time. I heard the example, and I'm sure it was just a top-of-mind example. I hearkened almost to the Beverly Hillbillies show where Jed hit something and there was like bubbling oil in the ground. It's my understanding that this is a colorless, odorless product that probably wouldn't bubble up. And I think what we're trying to do here, as evidence of all these people who show up here tonight, is that safety is a concern, right? And having a plan and knowing what is next. I don't think the emergency folks can plan for everything. But if it's odorless, colorless, and no one can see it or smell it, trying to understand how do we prepare if we're right there in harm's way? What kind of a emergency plan do we have in place now? I mean, is there like a blimp that goes up and says, get out, run away from the wind? Number two, there's retirement homes, there's schools, there's some folks that are going to have a hard time getting away from all this. So, again, with all due respect, I'm not convinced that there's a real hardcore plan here to get people out in the event. And again, with all due respect, 98.9 or 99.8 or whatever the number is, it's not 100%. I mean, in the UK, there was just a fire that everyone said would never happen. It did. So I'm asking, again, with all due respect, is there a plan to advise the community to get people out safely? Where do the kids go? And those are the kinds of questions I'd like to get some answers on.
Okay, so I'll try and address from the county perspective and also from the municipal perspective in terms of what I touched on a little bit of communications. We have many platforms at the county, including Ready Chesco, which includes our reverse 911, as well as some more antiquated going door-to-door, knocking on doors, or doing what we call route alerting through a megaphone. We have a lot of things in place in terms of platforms, and all of that really takes an all-hazards approach, as I mentioned before, whether it's a flood and a flood's about to impact a certain neighborhood, or in this case, the pipeline. Would basically we have a plan in place to get our message out. And a big piece of that is the public enrolling to get our alerts, or if there's an extreme situation where we need to issue an evacuation and we need to get a hold of people that are not enrolled in our platforms, we have the ability to use what is called the emergency alert system, which is a federal platform that we can basically push out to various mediums to get our message out. So that will all be occurring to get the message out. And in terms of getting the evacuation, you mentioned schools and nursing homes. So in Pennsylvania, like many other places, schools and nursing homes are required under state law to have all hazards plans in place that discuss how they're going to evacuate their populations, whether it be kids or the elderly. They're required to have that spelled out and where they're going to take them to. It's not just, okay, get us out of the building. It's what do you do with those individuals? So I will say that every school in Chester County and every nursing home in Chester County has an all-hazards plan that details evacuation procedures and what's going to occur and how that's all going to pan out. And we've tested an exercise. Another piece of that is that they have to test and exercise those plans, usually on an annual basis. One of the other things that we have in Chester County is what we call a reunification plan that we've worked with our law enforcement partners and other stakeholders to ensure that if a school particularly is evacuated or needs to move the student population for whatever reason to another location, that we have a very thorough plan in place to make sure that we can get those children to another facility, which may or may not be a school. We do not list those locations, but I will say we have 10 pre-identified locations throughout the county that we would move individuals or the students to and get them out of harm's way until the incident resolved. So between the communications plans and the evacuation plans, all of those are addressed in our planning and procedures. So
let me add to that and say this, and I mentioned to Joe, it's going to be important for him to answer this question. If you go on a PUC website under the pipeline safety, they have the jurisdiction here. PHMSA is the word that they use. That's a federal government jurisdiction under the Department of Transportation. The PUC is an agent for that in Pennsylvania. In this information, it basically says, or it doesn't, not basically, it does say, each operator, each pipeline operator, must have a damage prevention program and an emergency response program. And I would ask Joe what theirs is and where is it.
So we have, to that point, with the PUC, our primary regulators for safety and pipeline safety, the PUC at a state level and Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission, apologize for the acronyms, and PHMSA, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, our federal regulator. We have plans. They're reviewed and approved by them and, both on site with our operators as well as with those regulatory agencies. They're reviewed just like any plans that Bill and others talked about. They're generally always reviewed, gone over, and edited and added to. To the point of things that folks came up in terms of for the natural gas liquids and the questions about being odorless and colorless and how do you detect. And I think, no leak is a good thing, I will use that as an example. So, we weren't talking about, something that was gasoline in terms of the wet ground and the bubbling. You know, that was propane and ethane. So there is signs of a leak in terms of the soil, dead vegetation. If you look at it, that's another mention that was there. The bubbling does occur because it is a liquid. You know, when it's in the pipeline, much like folks that have gas grills, and you know they have that canister of propane. It's a liquid in your canister. When you turn the valve and open it, it turns into a gas. But it just doesn't switch immediately, right? There is a change, and there is some liquid or bubbling. You also have the other thing is a noise. Since everything is moving under pressure, our maximum operating pressure of our pipeline is 1440 psi. The reality is our closest pump station for Mariner East 1, we have a pump station at Boot Road. That's the 8-inch line. For the 20 and 16-inch lines, the closest pump station won't be anywhere in Chester County. Actually, be closer to Harrisburg, in Middletown. Not Middletown in Delaware County, but Middletown in Dauphin County. So it moves under pressure. And just like if you open a valve on your, anything, but we'll keep your propane grill as the example, you'll hear a noise, you'll hear a hiss, as that liquid, would be kind of leaving the pipeline, you would hear a noise that would also be there in terms of other indications of a leak. So I wanted to address that as well.
Could I mention if I could just add, could I add to the response to the question? From the standpoint of the public safety perspective, and certainly from the standpoint of the fire department that's likely going to be involved in running the incident, one of the most important things to us really is to have as much good information as we can if something's going wrong and as much advance notice as we can. So Sunoco talked about the fact that they have the ability to 24/7 monitor the pipeline. With that in mind, they monitor the pressure, the temperature, and the flow in the pipeline. And something that would make me sleep more comfortably at night is just to know that they're doing that constant monitoring and they basically have the processes in place, the commitment in place, that no matter when something happens, if they detect there's a problem, we're getting the immediate notification so we can do things on our end to protect the public. It's also going to be important that if the pipeline needs to be shut down, that they are prepared to make that commitment and not take a lot of time doing it.
If I may, we'll go right with you, ma'am. Lex, I want to make sure I mention a couple things. You talked about the no smell, bubbles, and your safety concerns, certainly valid. But one thing we do when we come out on emergency response, and believe it or not, and I think I didn't mention it, but just so you know, I'm responsible for the New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan pipeline operations, so I don't sleep all night either, Chief, to be honest with you. But when we send our people out, we have air monitors, just like the fire department does, and we'll get down there and we'll see it so we know, parts per million, there's numbers, there's levels, there's high levels, there's low levels. And in Morgantown, and back to David's question, when our guy went and sniffed it, it's pretty clear, even though it was odorless, it shows up on the parts per million and we know, so you don't have to dance around on whose it is. That's number one. Hopefully I answered Lex's question. Number two, for the chief, and not chief, if I'm calling it right, in our control center, and for those of you who remember me back from Boot Road, I used to work in there back in the mid-'80s. Lots changed over the years, but I can tell you that what he asked about monitoring pressures, flows, and temperatures, they do that. But I will also tell you that the technology that they use today doesn't rely on a human being staring at a computer screen. Thank goodness for that. You people are human. You don't focus on one thing. And some of those consoles that they operate on cover multiple line segments. So this line segment, Pittsburgh line segment, Buffalo, Rochester, whatever it is. But specifically to answer your question, it's computer modeled. So the human could see significant pressure flow changes, but the computer will start taking readings every seconds, every couple seconds. Don't hold me to the seconds. 5, 6, 7 seconds, whatever it is. And it puts it in this computer programming modulation. And it basically goes in, barrels in versus barrels out. And the computer will start to help them see things that they can't see with the human eye. And then eventually it'll give them an alarm level. And at that point, they got to react. They got to start investigating.
We might get a call before the police department does, or the fire department. And it actually, I don't want to bore you with the details, but you need to know. It actually will tell you 22 miles out, get a couple guys out there, and we'll get guys go both ways. We'll walk it, we'll drive it, we'll fly it. If the weather's good, we'll helicopter it, whatever it is. I want to find out what's going on. It could be a false alarm. It could be a transmitter going crazy, whatever it is. But just so you know, and then if the answer is we don't know, but that computer module still is showing something that's alarming, we will shut the line down and we will investigate until we figure out what's going on. So I absolutely will tell you that. That's what they do. That's their procedures. They don't need me to tell them. But if they're calling me out to send my guys out to look for it, that's the first question I ask. Are you still running? Do you have a visual? Do you have an odor? What do you got? What do you got going? And I'll say, just shut it down. We'll get a guy there in 20 minutes, half hour. And then we'll you know, work with the department, the fire, whatever it may be, and we'll make some type of intelligent decision, either to stay down or come back up. But that's the thought process involved. So. Sorry.
I'm a little too short. Hi, my name is Alice. There you go. My name is Alice Lenthy. I live at 627 Beaumont Circle in East Goshen. I have a two-part question. One is about the monitoring, the air monitoring that you do. I understand that if there's a report of some kind of suspicious leak that you will come out with air monitoring. But the first part of my question is, do you have air monitoring on a routine basis that would detect any kind of leakage before an event happens? The second part of my question, and I do appreciate everyone being here tonight because it is very informative, when it comes to an emergency response, there's a lot of planning, there's a lot of dependence on equipment and communications and that sort of thing. But if my geography is right, we have a huge substation right along the route. We have a police station and a fire station along the route of the pipeline. So if there were a serious event, and I'm a safety professional, so I know it can happen, even if it's never happened before, it will happen at some point, hopefully not here, but your response capabilities would be severely impacted. Your people might be taken out, your equipment, and especially the communications. You know, what is the backup plan? You know, how will people along the pipeline, you know, who are impacted, how will they even know if we don't have any electricity?
Alice, can I take your first question in regards to, is there air monitoring? Not on the line itself, but at the stations we have air monitoring, fire detectors, fire eyes, all those type of things. So the black and white answer is, in the stations, in the facilities, yes. On the main line, in between those stations, in between those valves, the answer is no. And I don't know if one of the township or fire wants to say, but in regards to plan B, you know, that's a thing where many plans do you have, but the issue is, and I think you heard it before, is when the incident's beginning, there's a lot of things that take place that we didn't bore you with the details. But you get out there and you do a physical hazard assessment of what you got, what the wind direction is, do you have a vapor cloud, is it small, is it bubbling, all these things factor into all of these decisions made at this table, since they're probably there first. So all those type of things might say then what your next step is in working in conjunction with the local emergency officials. So I think that's kind of the way, at least that I look at it.
And just to touch on our assets and, you know, the part of the question of what if there's a loss of electricity or anything like that, all of our automated assets, so and folks have talked about valves shutting off automatically. So for Mariner East 1 and Mariner East 2, the automatic valves are essentially, you know, right near each other. So Mariner East 1, the system that exists already, there's a valve at that Boot Road pump station right at 202 and Boot Road. And the other automated valve is just right pretty much at the county line, so just on the other side of the town in Westtown in Thornbury Township, Delaware County. So there are the two automated valves, just to give you a perspective on where that is. Essentially, for Mariner East 2, they'll be pretty much in the same location. For on the I guess eastern end, it'll be right at that same location. On the western end, it'll be at the area next to Goshen Fire Department. That undeveloped lot there is where the valves will go. And all of our systems are battery backed up, so they have the ability to even if electricity goes down, you know, they'll shut in automatically on themselves. And then Charlie's team will send folks out to any of those sites to confirm, you know, that they're shut in and locked in, and take the systems down. So that's just to address that part on our assets.
With regard to your concern about the police department being along the pipeline, our main police station is along 202 in Westtown Township, and we're not close to the pipeline. The station that she's referring to, it is our substation, and our substation is very small. It only accommodates one or two officers at a particular time. But regardless of if every single police department or police station was right along the pipeline, that's one of the benefits of having mutual aid agreements, that if anything happens to us and we're understaffed, or in the case of a tornado, if the tornado were to hit us directly, that we can reach out to the agencies that surround us so that they can provide assistance to us. And with regard to communications, one of the reasons that Ready Chesco is such a beneficial thing is that most people are relying on their cell phones rather than on landlines. So in the event that your landline was taken down, you would still have the ability to receive information through your cell lines.
Hi, my name is Tony Peretta. I live at 1601 Bain Way in East Goshen. Again, thanks for everyone for being here. I see a lot of familiar faces from other meetings. My concern is something I brought up about 3 weeks ago at another meeting, and everyone's kind of hit on different aspects of it. But as we go back to David's first question and the repurposing of that 8-inch line, so that was done and product is flowing, is that correct?
Yes, since 2014.
So 2014. I myself, who live on the pipeline, was never made aware of that. Now I'm going to guess no one else in this room was either. If that's the case, Bill, if that's the case, how was any of the schools, nursing homes, able to put in place plans relative to, you know, that? Because the product that was flowing through those pipes before were different, perhaps gasoline, going from Marcus Hook, not going to Marcus Hook. Gasoline will evaporate and go up. These products today sit on the ground. We are at a high level where my property is. A lot of people in my neighborhood are not here because the pipeline is not on their property. But what they don't understand, this product will flow downhill to their homes. So there's a lot of great things that have been told, but the specifics and really getting to the meat of it has not been. So when we talk about automatic valves and shutting things off, that's great. I worked in the industry with computers and we programmed all that stuff. But there's pressure in the lines. Stuff's still going to leak out based on that pressure. We take pride, as Marty knows, and Carmine and the rest of the board, in our community. So we're out there cutting lawns. We have third-party people cutting lawns, and that stuff is leaking up along 352, and it gets ignited. Doesn't have to be an explosion, a rupture. It could be that small leak, but that small leak getting ignited then creates the rupture. So, first question, why weren't we notified? And I brought this up 3 weeks ago at the prior meeting of the repurposing. The letter I got said you were going to do maintenance. Never heard anything more. That concerns me moving forward because the whole discussion tonight is about tomorrow. We're living the problem today. The pipe exists carrying those products.
So a couple pieces. So first on the notification piece, you know, when even before Mariner East 2 was a project, and Mariner East 1, some folks remember Don Zalakowicz or Donnie Z, who's worked here and done a lot of the community outreach. So in terms of from a township perspective and a municipal perspective, you know, we were engaging, communicating with the township, even just to repurpose the line, letting folks know what was going on, talking in any, and I don't recall if we did, but in certain areas, you know, where we had integrity digs, and I know we, I don't know if we had them in the township, but I know we had integrity digs, you know, in Chester, Delaware County. You know, all those notifications were made. In addition, there's something called pipeline awareness, and folks reference kind of, you know, it's like a pamphlet that you get. It's done by mail. It's something that's coordinated that every pipeline operator has to do. And they're mailed out, as well as a specific notification was mailed out that those that there was a change in service in the pipe. In addition, I believe it was the chief or someone else that referenced, we had, knowing that it was a change in service and that the hazards, right, because there's a hazard in anything that we move that's it's all hydrocarbons and it's all flammable, is that we had these emergency responder outreach training. So we worked with the coordinating with the county LEPC and reaching out to have these training sessions in advance of the line being in operation. So, you know, we definitely did take a number of steps in terms of communication. In terms of Tony, your question in terms of you know, how that didn't reach you, I don't know. I can't answer that piece.
Please don't do that. Just let the people give the answers. And I know there's emotions, but it's not going to do any good to express them.
Yeah, but he can't give that answer if it's not true.
Let me. Sorry. I have to say something that we have found very difficult. And Tony, I'm going to answer your question directly. We have had four meetings with Sunoco, three of them in our building, and one of them here, starting well before Mariner 1 was repurposed. I mean, when they first filed, we were following it, and shortly thereafter, we had all that information. I would say every meeting we had in the township building, the room was full. The meeting here was definitely well attended, and it's going on our website, it's been in our newsletter, and it's been on Constant Contact. Now, we did all that. There is no secret about what was going on with Mariner 1, Mariner 2, Mariner 2X. All that information was communicated. The part that we have come to realize is that people are busy. And they don't really realize what's going on because they're not paying attention to that. They're busy with their lives. So the first time a lot of people ever saw anything or thought about anything was when they saw the pipe going at Matlack. And then a whole lot of things started happening. But all along the way, the township has communicated probably more than any township in the entire state. We've probably had more meetings with Sunoco and their representatives than anybody in the state. Unfortunately, because of the way the world works, there were some that were right there, right from the beginning, and there was others that didn't catch up with the process until it started happening, and they felt left out. And that's just the unfortunate way it is. We've learned from that. Now, I'm not suggesting that we're going to know what to do if the next pipeline comes through, because I hope another pipeline never comes through this place. But the point of the matter is, right now, we have thoroughly communicated with the residents what was going on from day one till now. But I understand why people say they didn't know. The only reason they didn't know is because they weren't paying attention, but I understand why they weren't paying attention, because they're busy. And that's the way it is. Tony, Mary, I made my comments. Let the people ask the questions. If you want to come up, and then you can ask a question, whatever you want. Tony, okay. I'm not blaming anybody. I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just saying life is the way it is. Tony, the gentleman has a question. Go ahead.
Okay. First, my name is Alan Pond. Can you guys hear me?
Okay. Tony, you're going to have to come up to the mic because we can't hear you from down there.
All right. Is it okay? All right. My name is Alan Pomerantz, and I live at 1141.
Wait a minute. Hold it.
Okay.
No way you get in line.
Oh, no, come on. We're going to have a problem if you don't let him up here.
Go to it, guy.
We're going to have to let him up here. It's going to be a problem.
Plain and simple, when someone wants a variance for extension of their garage,
I get notices out of the wazoo. This is a lot more important.
I don't know what he said.
This is a lot more important than a variance. So the way you notify me about variances, this is a hell of a lot more important, excuse my language, but that's how you should have notified us. Not because I travel 80% of my time, I can't make it to the meetings. That's not your notification. You notify us the way you notify us about everything. And you do that, you want constant contact, or your prior systems,
right,
fine.
Let me answer that question, Tony, this way. When we had a meeting scheduled, we sent a letter out to every resident within 1,000 feet.
Now, you know what?
Some people say they didn't get it. We have sent the letter out. Why you didn't get it, I don't know. Every meeting. And then more recently, we did 2,000 feet. And for this meeting, we sent a postcard out to everybody in the entire township. Now, I'm not sure, Tony, what we could do more than we did.
I'll tell you what more you could do, Marty. In the incidents when we talked about meetings earlier on, you sent them out almost the day before the meeting.
No, it's
not
true. Well,
someone who travels as much as I do for my job before I retired, okay, sending out a week or two sometimes isn't enough. I may be out of town for a month, 3 weeks. So you know what? You don't put this together, you know, in a week, 2 weeks' time. So when it's locked up, send it out to us, and send it out to us electronically. Because if I'm traveling, I could get that. The mail, you know, I'm not home to get it.
1,000 foot, whenever I'm going on this contact, right? For those that don't know, and it's, it becomes really important in this exercise because it speaks a little bit to Tony's point. We have a constant contact, which some people run, some people aren't. If you go on our website, you can sign up for constant contact. You can get anything that comes out in the township, or you can put it down to just the pipeline or agendas, whatever you want. Anytime anything has come out with respect to Sunoco Pipeline at all, it is going out under constant contact. There isn't a soul here that can say that they're on constant contact, they didn't get all the notifications, whether you're home or not. I encourage everybody, because unfortunately, Sunoco is going to be visiting us for the next, 18 to 24 months. And there's going to be a lot of information going in and out when we learn different things. I would encourage everybody to sign up for constant contact. We have said the same thing in every meeting, and there's only like a couple thousand people that are on constant contact, and there's more than one in each household. So we have 8,400 homes in East Goshen, or 8,500. So we have a long way to go to get everybody, but I encourage people to do that. But it solves the problem that you're talking about, Tony, because if, in fact, it's there, you can't miss it. But if we send a letter, even when you get home, at least you saw the letter and you know something happened. So the point, and when I write the newsletter, I can't speak for anybody else. There's always something about Sunoco in there. Mm-hmm. And the columns now are getting a little longer than they were before. So I myself, if I was in your shoes, I want to know as much as I can. My job is to make, without being ridiculous about it, is put as much information as I can possibly out there. Ricky updates that thing usually once a week where something happens with respect to our website. So I encourage people that are very interested in this, which is certainly are, to use the website or to use constant contact, because everything that happens is in one of those two places. The newsletter is a little late, and it's a little historic than it is more current, but at least it tells you what has gone on and what probably will be going on as long as Sunoco has told us what's happening. So I appreciate what you're saying, Tony. I'm not suggesting anybody's at fault. I'm suggesting we're on a learning curve, but I can say that we do have the means to communicate with residents if the residents want to take it up and use it.
I just want, as everyone else here does, straight, honest, straightforward answers. Joe, you're looking at me. You can remember our conversation from the prior meeting. That's all we want, honesty. And right now I'm not feeling that because I have a pipeline in my backyard carrying these products, and I've never been told. I've never gotten anything in the mail, and I'm not waiting for a card once a year to tell me about that. Sunoco, the township, the state, whoever, or all, has a responsibility to all of us. You started off talking about safety and your responsibility to the community. Well, it starts there. Give us all clear, concise, timely notifications, based on what's good for us, not what's good for you.
Well, we understand that.
Okay.
We understand it.
I'm going.
Thank you, Tony. Okay.
I'll try again. All right. My name is Alan Pomerantz, and I live at 1141 Murrayfield Drive. And I have a different question. First, I want to say that I think our response team and the people here are superb, and I back them 100%. Okay? Now, having said that,
I'm going to say thank you, but I might have to wait.
Oh, okay. No, now having said that, my concern is I have heard things at meetings that basically make them useless, okay, that has nothing to do with their skills, their preparation, or anything, okay? For example, if there is a leak, that bubbling thing where the farmer found it, well, maybe that leak happens on the golf course here and nobody sees it. Because this stuff is heavier than air, it will flow downhill, it will go into people's basements. If somebody on the golf course just happens to turn on their cell phone or even a light, they can ignite that and burn down the whole damn village, okay? And the problem is it doesn't be any good to have evacuation plans and safety plans and other, because we're burning up. That's number one, okay? And the second thing is that I have heard, now you guys can tell me if I'm wrong to these things, the second thing I've heard is that anybody within 200 feet of this leak will be asphyxiated because this stuff replaces the oxygen in your blood. And you've got it within 100 feet of a Catholic school and 25 feet of apartments, okay? I don't know what good, if that's true, I don't know what good a plan is, okay? Because it happens way for. And third, I've also heard that the blast radius on this is 1,500 to 2,000 feet. And I was told that by Pennsylvania law, the first responders cannot go into that blast area. They have to wait for that. And if that's true, those people from the nursing home at Wellington are not walking a half mile. So I could be wrong on all those points, so please tell me.
You raise a very good point, and I want to help, and I want to translate this around for the Sunoco people, and I want to be really clear. Because it's probably the most important thing that they're going to answer tonight, and it goes right to your question. They have different kind of impacts or incidents. They can have a pinhole leak. They can have a relatively small leak. They can have a medium-sized leak. They can have a large leak, or they can have a rupture.
Right.
Every one of those things have its own consequence, some much less than others. And every one of those things has a probability, some much more probable than others. It's imperative in my mind that before we leave tonight, and those scenarios, that Sunoco tells us what the consequences of each of those are and what the probability of occurrence is, because that drives right to the issue that you're talking about.
Okay. Can you say that any of those three things that I said are not true? Forget the probabilities, because those people in the Catholic school are not going to want their kids there, regardless of the problem. I want to know if the three things I said are not true.
Well, they should be answering both these questions, and that's the whole story.
Right, but I don't want a probability. I want to know if those things are even true. I've heard them at other meetings. Do you guys want to say whether or not they're true?
Okay. Let me address as far as the properties of the materials. Yes, they are heavier than air. The vapors are heavier than air. They will tend to flow downhill, much like a liquid. Okay. As far as the health effects, no, they do not affect your blood. They are what is known as a simple asphyxiant.
Thank you.
They are something that they would drop the oxygen level in an enclosed area. So it's not like carbon monoxide, which
right.
we have a problem, which gets in and interferes with your blood.
Right.
This would tend, if confined into an enclosed area, could drop the oxygen levels and could be a health hazard from that respect. I'm not sure where this information about the first responders not being allowed into an area and that is coming from. That's the first that I've quite honestly heard about it. And, you know, one of our primary goals in any incident is life safety. That's the first thing we're going to be concerned about. So I'm not sure where that's coming from. Bob, do you want to address anything on that?
I don't think there is such a...
Okay. That's why I asked.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that information is coming from either. And as we've said throughout this, life safety is going to be important, life safety for the responders, life safety for the residents we're protecting. And without a doubt, you know, we're going to do all the things we need to do to fully understand the type of situation we're dealing with. Okay. One of the things that Sunoco talked about, and on behalf of the fire company, we're going to have some follow-up discussion with Sunoco about a number of things as well. You talked about detection systems you will have at the pumping station at Green Hill and Boot, correct? Across the street from the firehouse?
Yes.
And you also talked about you'll probably have some type of monitoring equipment at the valves you're going to put next to the firehouse?
Yes.
So, I mean, one of the things we may ask for from the standpoint of the firehouse is that if that monitoring equipment's not sufficient to let us know at the firehouse, we may be asking for you to put whatever monitoring equipment necessary in the firehouse so we're not taken by surprise in terms of a leak.
Yeah, and a couple pieces to address your question. And in terms of the information, you know, a lot of it really isn't accurate.
Well,
so,
that's okay.
The first
that's
piece,
what I
so the for the first piece, so on a rupture, right? So for the worst case scenario or something like that, Charlie talked a little bit about our systems. So the kind of smart system we have, Leak Detect, so in a rupture scenario where the pipe just breaks and product would flow out, you automatically, the system automatically locks itself in. So it doesn't even wait for somebody to read a monitor. It doesn't beep and have somebody react. The valves lock themselves in. The valves take, depending on the size, I think it's approximately 30 to 90 seconds to lock in on the valves. So that's the first part. So in terms of the asphyxiation, and in general where some of this comes from, you know, there was a flawed study that was done by the Middletown Coalition where they used a lot of incorrect data, right? So bad data in, you know, leads to bad data out. In terms of the asphyxiation, I'm not aware of anything that would lead to that.
He just said that in a closed space. Well, the basement's in an enclosed space.
I was just going to add in terms of a confined space. Yeah. So, however, you know, in terms of our pipeline being in an open atmosphere, you really don't have that.
Okay.
So in terms of the probabilities as well, what I'll go back to, and I know that wasn't part of your question, but Marty had asked it, so I need to answer that as well. You know, in terms of an impact, two things. First, again, using, you know, example in terms of what happens with a leak. The example that Charlie had talked about where you come out with monitors and detect, there's a lower and upper flammability level for anything in terms of when you would have an ignition or something could light off. So in that scenario, it was always below the lower flammability level. So there was never even a threat for what they call ignition, but essentially a fire. So again, an important thing in terms of understanding. You know, addressing those other issues. Talked about asphyxiation.
They addressed the blast radius one, and they semi-addressed the in the sense that it's not that dangerous, but it is still dangerous with the asphyxiation. And apparently there's no rule that says that they can't go into the blast zone.
So. Yeah, and there's something they address. So, because some people have said another thing just while we're talking about it, that, you know, you need to evacuate a 5 or this 10-mile radius. And, you know, I'll let kind of the experts in emergency response talk more about it, but you have something called an emergency response guidebook. Again, that covers pretty much anything that runs a gamut in terms of hazards. And, you know, the recommendation for something like propane, ethane, butane is a half mile in terms of an evacuation radius. So that's kind of the textbook answer for that as well.
I'm Bill Donaldson at 987 Kennett Way. Most of my concerns are radio communications. Most of the incident reviews across the country, it seems that when police do their drills, they never foresee communication problems. I mean, serious problems. So my first question is, will you all be on the same channel?
Yes and no. Each agency, there are separate channels for police, separate channels for fire. There are large-scale channels. There are closer-in, more detailed tactical channels also. And then there also are command channels available. So the senior leadership would have the ability to intercommunicate, and that's also part of unified command. The best way to have command is to have all of us sitting together in the same spot where we're communicating face-to-face, not relying on radios. But the radio system is pretty robust. It has a lot of capabilities. The county just spent $43 million, thank you, on upgrading it in that. So, you know, communications is always going to be an issue. Every after-action report you read is going to identify, we could have communicated better, we could have done things better. It's one of those things where we always strive to improve it. But we're actually in pretty good shape.
So you agree you have a special channel to go to on Sirius since? Because we're talking about backup situations.
We already have pre-designated in the system, there are what we refer to as mutual aid channels, which allow police to fire and EMS and intercommunication. They're already pre-designated in the system.
Yeah, and I'll piggyback on that. The new system, it is one system countywide that all municipal emergency response agencies are on, with the exception of the state police. But we do have patches to be able to connect in with the state police. But every municipality in Chester County on the new system also has what we call a local talk group. So there is a channel that everybody could switch to in a municipality, police, fire, EMS, public works, emergency managers, and talk on one channel.
Does the local Sunoco pump station, for instance, have a handheld police radio, the pump station?
Not at the station, but we have them in our emergency response, and what we would do is either use theirs or get our guy to come channel up and hook up to their level.
So we have to, the site command has to hunt you down to communicate with you in a matter of minutes.
Their representative is going to report in to the command post, okay, and he's going to be integrated into the unified command system. Then he would have communications with his personnel also. But he's going to be in as part of that integrated command system.
And what we do also, Bill, is one of the calls I'll make is have our communication person bring a bunch of portables and repeaters. Not that the county don't have them. And what we'll do is we'll set them up in approved places so that we could get immediate updates from our field personnel. How are you doing? Where are you at? What's happening? What's going on?
So you have free lines of travel to get to a radio. In a matter of minutes.
Once they get to
the
site.
For an assessment, or to give an assessment.
Correct.
See, what happens with police drills is that often they don't practice radio discipline. And then you have the real thing. And I'm a retired police commander with an urban experience. So when you do these practice drills, you got to practice the communications and what if. And the big problem is often agencies are not able. Well, at 9/11... the firemen couldn't talk to policemen and vice versa. So that's what I'd just like some reassurance from the public safety officials that you think your radio communications are up to snuff, that you're going to be able to handle a real, honest-to-goodness emergency. That's all I really wanted to hear.
Yeah, without question, we'll be able to do that. And okay. When we got the new radio system and we got the new portable radios and the mobile radios for the trucks, we had the opportunity to set up the frequencies, the bands, and everything we needed to do. And basically, we took into account all the types of incidents we would have, who we would need to talk to in particular incidents and so forth, and the righteous radios we have, plus the HAZMAT team in particular has intrinsically safe radios if they're going to be working in hazardous environments and so forth, and they've had them since the start.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Bob. I appreciate that reassurance.
With regard to police involvement in these incidents, we've come light years since 9/11. 9/11 taught us about interoperability, which is partly what he's talking about, agencies being able to talk to each other. As a result of 9/11, a lot of funds have been made available to upgrade radio systems and to also ensure interoperability. And because the county has been so diligent in doing all hazards planning and training, I think that we've got a good hold on making sure that there is radio discipline. That's one of the things that in the debriefing we routinely talk about, whether there was a problem with that. So I think we've made great strides since 9/11.
My name is Mary Ann Kustner. I live at 1026 Kennett Way in Hershey's Mill. I am glad I came this evening. And I'll start with the group that spoke first. And now, of course, you've been talking about your radio communication. The thing I'm interested in is time. From the time, is there an alarm that would sound that everybody would hear it, the fire department, everybody, and realize that there's a huge emergency? Just a sound that then people have to really find out where is this and what is your timing on this?
So are you talking about a system that would just notify the responders that there is a call that they need to respond to?
An emergency. Okay. If you have a huge emergency.
Sure. So
how do you handle that, and are you notified, and how much time does it take?
So once a call comes into our dispatch center, usually it's being dispatched within 90 seconds. That basically what Don just handed me here is a pager that every first responder is issued, whether it be fire, EMS, police are always on duty. They carry a radio system. So depending on if it's a fire or a police incident will depend how it's sent out. We also have mobile data terminals in all vehicles. So there's a lot of redundancy, whether it's going to come through in their computer in their vehicle, it's going to come through these pagers, it's going to come over the radio and through their phones as well. With this new technology, there's multiple pathways that the call is going to be received, and also processes and procedures in place to ensure that it's acknowledged. So it's not just sent out and they expect, you know, an automatic response. There's time built in that if they don't hear from the officer or the responder to respond, that they're going to do a system or a status check and make sure that they got it. And if there's no response, then they would go to a mutual aid responder to ensure that somebody's coming there. And that all happens very quickly in sequence. So,
okay. How many people are you notifying for this major problem? No matter who they are, how many would be notified immediately?
If in a case where it was Goshen Fire Company, the police, the hazmat,
everybody.
It could be upward over 100, 150 people for the initial dispatch.
Okay, and it would take 90 seconds to reach them and tell them where it is, and they all go.
From the time that the buttons hit the transmission, however long the message is, it's instant. Once it's hit, it goes to every path and it goes out over the air as a broadcast.
Okay, so you would all assemble there. You're not sitting and saying, well, I'm the commander and that we need to do this or that. That's what it seemed to me like this was a very slow process you were going through. And what I wanted to know, have you ever had you see these mock things that happen in other places, a major emergency. Do you ever see how long it takes for everybody to assemble and to do something?
Yeah, let me take that. We do drills and exercises all the time, and we actually evaluate them. And at times, we have other people come in and evaluate them from the outside to really look at the metrics of doing that. One of the things the county looks at, Department of Emergency Services, on a monthly basis is the time it takes to receive calls, to do dispatches, and so forth. You know, they have all the statistics. We take a look at those statistics. If I understand your question correctly, part of it is the key thing is when do the resources get where they need to be to do what they need to do?
And start working, not just gather there and say, now, let's see what we're going to do and who's going to do what.
Right. I mean, as an example.
That's what I want to know.
If there were an incident involving the pipeline near Wellington, if I were the person responding incident commander from where I live, I would be there in less than a minute. And basically, the chief officers are going to be coming directly. The chief officers.
So they would all assemble there.
The chief officers are not going to go to the firehouse to get apparatus or whatever.
Oh.
They're going to respond directly to wherever the incident is.
Yes, go to the place.
Right.
Okay. And you've done these mock drills to see how long it takes you to get there, how you get people out. Have you done all this, and how long
does
it take?
Yeah. I don't have the specific numbers in front of me, but we do those drills on a regular basis.
Okay.
And the other thing is just to come up with a different type of scenario. When the plane went down about 2 years ago now near Harrison Hill apartments, townhouses, whatever, off 202,
right.
It was just minutes before we had a large group of resources there, and we were communicating, letting people know what was going on and so forth.
Oh, okay, because it seemed to me it was taking too long. Because I, in my job, I worked operating room and delivery room.
Right.
And when there was an emergency, I didn't even talk to anybody. I just went and I acted. So there was none of this, and everybody did the same thing, and you took care of things.
Well, first of all, that everybody showing up and just figuring out what they need to do, we refer to that as freelancing. That need not happen ever, particularly in a situation like that. The incident commander, the people involved, the command staff are going to get there. They're going to quickly size up what they have. We're going to exercise the policies and procedures we have, the protocols as to how we deal with things, and we're going to have an organized plan as to how we're going to deal with this particular incident.
And that takes how much time?
Just a matter of minutes.
Okay.
And Mary, could I add something to you, a few questions?
Sure.
We also do drills and exercises. And since it's not just facilities, we do it remote locations on a pipeline to see how long it takes people to get there, because we're stretched out all over a bunch of states, as I mentioned. So we do the same. We do drills and exercises. But the point I wanted to mention, and I think the chief was saying it also, is when you have an emergency, like I was kind of mentioning, you don't go somewhere and set up incident command and talk about what's going on down the road. The first thing everybody does, I don't want to lump us all together, but we get people to the site and find out what's going on, life and health, you know, communities, rivers, whatever it may be. Meanwhile, somebody else may be in the township building setting up the closest incident command office they can find. But it's not this first and then that. It's to the site first. And then, for example, I might go to the site or meet these gentlemen and ladies, but Joe might be setting up incident command with Marty in a hotel conference room down the street. You know what I mean? So they're both going on at the same time. There's no delay.
Okay. And I think your name was it Joe? You're in the command center. I was interested in that because I thought that it was going to happen rather quickly, and finally somebody did say that it would take just a matter of seconds, and you would be able to shut that entire pipeline down.
So
correct?
So it depends on the scenario. So
if there's an incident.
And it depends on, like folks have talked about different levels of incident. So our pipelines, we measure pressure, temperature, and flow. So some folks have talked about, you know, a worst-case scenario. So a pipeline where they would call a rupture. So in something like that, with the systems and leak detection we have, it measures, there's an algorithm essentially, and when that's triggered, the system will lock in. So the automated valve, so for example, anywhere in East Goshen, you know, you have valves essentially right at the West Goshen, East Goshen border, and one just at the Delaware County Chester line essentially, and they would lock in. So that in that scenario, that's what would happen. Now in a scenario like the one we talked about where, and again, it's in terms of risk, it's all about, you know, impact and probability. So so in a leak scenario, like the one we described and we've kind of used as a case study for tonight in Reading or Morgantown, rather.
No, let's talk about a worst-case scenario.
Yeah.
The little ones, okay, we can deal with that. What about the one where there's a rupture and there's a fireball that goes 100 feet in the air, and that goes for quite a distance?
So in terms of a rupture, right, so you have two scenarios there, or two stages. You have a release, and the air ultimately, and folks have talked about, you know, any of these natural gas liquids are heavier than air, but ultimately, just like anything else, there's dissipation. So there's a lower and upper flammability level where that would dissipate and no longer be ignitable. You know, in terms of any fire, if a fire were to occur, you'd have it would ignite and flash and return to the source, which would, if it was the case of our pipeline, be the pipeline.
Wait a minute. It returns to the source. What do you mean by that? This whole fire goes back into the pipeline?
So the source, so if you turn on, if you have a gas stove, so you have the natural gas that comes out,
right,
and then it would ignite as a fire. So the as long as the gas stays heated, that's the ignition source. So
right,
essentially,
and you turn it off, though, and it goes off.
Correct. So essentially, whatever would be there, you know, and you lock in the system and the valves, you know, that would burn off but go back to the source.
Okay. Now, this source is it's highly volatile.
Yeah.
It's going through Mariner 2.
So in any of our pipelines, they're all it's all hydrocarbons, so whether it would be gasoline, whether it be diesel fuel, whether it be jet fuel,
let's talk
propane,
about,
ethane.
Let's talk about Mariner 2 right now.
Sure.
That's what we're living with.
Sure.
Okay? And those are highly volatile liquids, correct?
Yeah, that's how they're defined.
That's right. And so this is very flammable.
Yes. Yeah, everything that we move is absolutely flammable.
Okay. So we still don't have an idea of how long this is going to take. And, of course, it can go even 2,000 yards. Could go further than that.
What I was trying to capture at the beginning is in your different scenarios. So as you talked about it, you lock in a system. There's only so much.
No, we're talking about a fireball and it's traveling and it can go that far.
What I was trying to say is when something ignites, it will go back to. And again, I'm not an expert in the field, but the basics of it, it's going to ignite and then return. Any fire will go back to the source, whatever an ignition source is.
How long is that going to take?
It flashes and returns seconds.
No. There are fires that have occurred, and they've decimated places, okay? And it can go 2,000 feet. And do you know where I got my information from? The Department of Transportation in Woods. And I have this in writing from him. And he is in charge, one of the ones that's the liaison in the northeastern part of the United States.
Yeah. Well,
I'm sure you know him.
I don't, and I'm not saying that he's not credible in terms of a source. But there's a number of things that go into, any type of scenario. There's the pressure of the pipeline at a certain point, how much product is moving, how much product is there, and then wind speed, direction, a number of factors.
Okay, worst case scenario, all right, which can happen.
Sure.
That's what we're concerned about. The little leaks and the little things that happen, I mean, that's not going to bother us. But we're concerned about, what about our lives? How do we handle this? And we can't really handle it. So what do we do with this?
So, let me take a shot.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mary, I don't have, I'm not an engineer, so I can't describe the wind velocity and stuff, but If we had an event and there was a rupture or a third party hit us, whatever it would be, and you have that product, highly volatile liquid coming out of the pipe, right?
Right.
Your biggest concern, and I'm not saying what that gentleman looked at, but if it's under pressure,
yes,
and they don't shut down like the chief asked about, then you could potentially have something reaching down quite a distance, whatever quite means. The key is, though, in this system, in that particular example, and I don't want to bore you with the details, but if the system sees a drastic drop in pressure and flow, those valves will close. The origin pump, pump it in like your hose. You shut your hose off, eventually that water dies down, right? That'll close those valves on both sides. And so, therefore, that stream of heavy pressured HVLs starts to go down immediately. Okay? So if somebody were not to shut down, a line down like that, and anything, product, water, you name it, it's going to continue to shoot in the air for as long as it possibly could until somebody shuts it down. So I think that's part of your answer, or our answer to you, is that happens, the system picks it up, shuts the valves down, and then that thing, whatever's out, if it ignites somehow, some way, it's got to ignite.
Right.
With minimizing, like Joe's saying, it kind of comes back to its original hole and then until it dies down.
Okay, so you're assuring us that if we live 2,000 feet, we have nothing to worry about. You're assuring us if we live 2,000 feet from there, we have nothing to worry about.
Mary, I wish I could tell you that. All I can tell you is under catastrophic failure that you're referencing, is those systems will work. They're tested twice a year. It'll shut down. That's the key, is to shut down the pressure that's putting pressure on that pipe. That's critical, no matter what it is. So if, when that happens, and I'm assured it does, it will, it's done, then that whether it's a vapor cloud unignited or, God forbid, a vapor cloud ignited,
right,
it's not going to travel forever. It's just going to die. There's no force pushing it. You know what I mean?
With regard, I'd like to tap into earlier question that she asked. If any residents of East Goshen would like to see actual dispatching, how a call comes in, how resources are deployed, and how long it takes them to respond, we ought to offer a Citizens Police Academy. And one of the weeks of the Citizens Police Academy, you get to go to the Emergency Dispatch Center and actually listen to and hear calls dispatched. So if she has that concern, we welcome you to join us.
Hello, my name is Gordon Yoakum, 1054 Kennett Way. Looks like Kennett's out in force today, which is a good thing. I had two questions. One, I think, was already answered by Joe. I'm a former Sunoco employee. I was an employee for 12 years. I'm a former emergency responder on the refining side for tank cars and tank trucks. I don't know anything at all about pipelines, but I do know that when we responded to rail car disasters, specifically ethylene, which in this case was shipped cryogenically. And you're not moving this cryogenically. This is all under pressure. And you said 1,440 PSI?
So that's the maximum operating pressure, but the pressures will vary. So I tried to give the example. So for an 8-inch line, you have a pump station, so the pressure would be higher since there's a pump station at Boot Road. For the 20 and 16-inch, which are Mariner East 2, it's further away, so pressure would be less.
Where I'm going with this is very often out in the field when we would have a rupture, very often we didn't contain it. We either had to flare it, we either had to, you know, gather it in some other way until the contents of the car or the pressure equalized. When you've got a pipeline this size, okay, you talk about shutting it off. If you've got, let's say, 1,000 pounds PSI running through it, and depending on the side of the rupture, you're going to shut this down, how long does that take? It's not like a garden hose, which is going to just dribble down quickly. This could take some time. How often do you space these shutoff valves? Are they every 300 yards? Are they every 300 miles? I mean, you're going to have a lot of dissipation, a lot of time where that material is going to be escaping. Do you have any feel for how long that would go?
Gordon, I don't have the exact. I mean, it's something we get, but our engineers can tell you that. You know, if you had such and such a hole and valve shut at such and such a time, we can get that information for you. Just get it back to us. But the other point I want to make is, you're right. Just like the garden hose, eventually it still takes time. Doesn't matter how long it is. But what we do on the NGO lines, the ones that all of you are concerned about, that's different than a gasoline line and a refinery product line, whatever you want to call it. And I can tell you that if you have an issue like that, one of the first things you know you learn when you run this stuff is that hole has got to be cleaned out and purged ASAP. You can't mess around with it like back in the day and you put a clamp on it in a refinery. You guys did that a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do that on an HVL line. Can't do it. So the minute we talk to these gentlemen and ladies and know we got a problem and those valves do close, we have a lot of connections on the valves where we'll basically blow that thing clear. Now, is it like this? No. It takes some time to get the equipment, the nitrogen trailers.
Right.
We'll blow that thing clear. That's a new thing that adds a little bit of timing to it, not complexity, timing, because you're right. Depending on the elevation, I mean, that thing could be right at the base, above two little hills. So that all the things are varying, like Mary was saying. It all could be different. But that's how we approach that. Say, all right, we got something underground that's coming up. Hopefully it's not a rupture, but something's down there. I don't know how big it is. I don't know how big the crack is or somebody hit us, whatever it is. We immediately initiate a nitrogen purge on this HVL because that's the only way we're going to get to it, and that's the only way we're going to find out what happened and ultimately repair it.
Okay, so it is a process. It's not instantaneous.
It is a process.
Okay, that's
but the pressure will go down right away. I don't want to tell you it's not, but you're right. It won't go to zero.
Okay. All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Melissa DiBernardino. I'm at 1602 Old Orchard Lane. I do want to thank you because I want to say that other than the pipeline, I've never felt more safe in my life with the training and experience that you guys have. I just don't know that it seems to cut it with the pipeline, and I feel like we're kind of dancing around some questions. I have two children in St. Peter and Paul School. They are 100 feet from the pipeline. So what I'm wondering is if there is a leak detected and Charlie, you're out there with your Ghostbusters thing trying to get readings and stuff, like at what point are people evacuated? And I totally respect that I don't want to know where they go or how, I mean, I guess where they go, but I need to know. I feel like you guys aren't answering the question that cars can be started, can't be started in this. Can, like, ambulances and stuff go in however you guys would retrieve my children from there and take them to safety, or do they need to evacuate on foot?
Sure. So there are a lot of different scenarios, but I guess to try to simplify, again, looking at all the hazards that are out there, there's either going to be something that's outside and we don't want the children to go out into. which in place the school would have a plan, whether they call it a lockdown or a shelter-in-place plan, or there's going to be maybe there's something inside or something in the immediate vicinity that we need to get everybody out of that area, at which time basically the responders would determine a shelter-in-place order or an evacuation. Based on what that order is, the evacuation or shelter-in-place would commence immediately based on the school's existing procedures. And then if it were an evacuation, we would activate our reunification plan, and I understand that you would want to know where those children are going, but because of their
safety. No, I said I don't need to know that. I want to know how you're getting them out, though.
Yeah, so
do they need to move on foot? Are you actually loading them into buses?
Yep.
Can that be around?
So initially they would be moved out of the immediate harm's area if they could evacuate, and then using either pre-existing contracts with companies such as CRAF or school district buses, they would be transported to the alternate location where we would commence what is called reunification with the families, and communication would basically start immediately to let the parents know where their children were being taken and where to come to. And at that facility, there's a whole process in place of what we call reunification that actually has been extensively tested and exercised here in Chester County in terms of the plan. I mean, it's a very thorough and something we take very seriously plan that we have in place in terms of parent-child reunification. So,
I think that's wonderful. My children are alive to, you know, reunificate with. But what is – you guys have had an internal, like, risk assessment type thing, I'm assuming? Like, you know what the blast radius is?
Oh,
with this?
I thought you meant inside the pipe, are you talking about, or just something happens?
Listen, I know that East Township didn't find it necessary to have a risk assessment. You guys, however, Sunoco did, correct?
So, we have risk assessments that are coordinated with, like I had mentioned before, the PHMSA, for example, as a federal response.
Right. So, from what I've read, you can have a blast zone up to 1,800 feet. So, does that mean St. Peter and Paul is leveled at that point?
Yeah,
and if the answer is yes and they need to shelter in, is there like a bomb shelter that I'm unaware of?
So one thing to address the question, because I think what you're referring to probably comes from the Middletown Coalition study. So they used some data they had in part.
I've read a lot of things. It's not.
Yeah. Well, that's one of them. So that's the only one that I know that's specific to, you know, Mariner East 2, essentially. You know, a lot of things in terms of their factors. So they had a part of it, you know, where they had certainly a reputable firm look at it. But they had, and they came up, you know, with a number, you know, similar to what you're talking about. So a couple points, if just bear with me to try to explain it. Mm-hmm. Hopefully I'll address it.
You guys can bore me all you want with details. It's kind
okay.
of important.
Yeah. So two parts of it. First, there's a lot of flaw data, including, you know, the pressure of the pipe. The volumes that would be in the pipe because of essentially misassuming that there would be a pump station. I talked about that closer than there is. They had some of that data. However, even with the flawed data that's over-assuming numbers, one of the things, if I recall, that the study basically said is that there wouldn't be concussion, so an impact to buildings. So there wouldn't be an impact in terms of the area they focused on was their local school.
Which is 650 feet away. Not that, I mean, anything around this is horrible. I don't mean to discredit anybody for being farther away than my kids are.
Can I say something?
Sure, please.
A very valid question. And the locals, the emergency officials, they have evacuation plans, right? So we're not experts on that. But what I could tell you what I believe, hopefully, is a prudent manager of a pipeline operation, if I got one of those calls, and I think all my peers would be the same, and they're like, I think the assumption is you have a vapor cloud, it's an automatic explosion. It's not necessarily true. Something's got to ignite it, right? You need that third triangle. You need that piece to light it off or light a fire.
Right. Is it an engine starting or a cell phone being used?
It depends on the concentration, like we talked about. But I want to get to the point, yes, it could happen.
Okay.
But what I wanted to say to you and the homeowners, and if I got a call, I think if any one of these men or women got a call, and there's a vapor cloud near a school, then I don't know what the plan is per se, but I know I'd be talking to these guys and gals, they'd be talking to me. We're evacuating. I mean, I don't care if somebody don't like it in the corporate structure or whatever, you know, because nothing happens, but you evacuate. That's not the point. The point is, you know, when those calls come in to us, and especially the local emergency responders, you know, life is the most important thing. If somebody tells me the school's 400 feet away and it's in session, I say, you got to get them out of there. Man. Run in there, do what you got to do, get the police officer, get them out.
100.
Upstream or, you know, get don't go to where the cloud's blowing or whatever, but just get them out. But
right, so but they're expecting a school of students and then a nursing home next door to evacuate on foot running upwind, whatever the hell that means. Right. I mean, if they're throwing a feather up, there's a lot of, like, deciding here, and it seems like there's not a lot of time before something horrible can happen.
I think Bill tried to address, and folks on the county side, you know, and again, it's not our expertise, but every school,
respond.
No, but it's not our expertise for the school emergency response. Or what our response is.
Yeah. Let me add to that if I could. And I'm going to approach this from the county perspective rather than Goshen's perspective. We have been really aggressive in recent years through the Chester County Local Emergency Planning Committee and DES working on school planning for all types of risks and hazards. With that in mind, we've worked diligently for many years with the Chester County Intermediate Unit. We've made sure that we cast a broad net and all schools are involved in the things that we're doing. And 2 weeks from now, on July 10th, we actually have a three-hour meeting scheduled with Westchester Area School District and representatives of all the emergency response organizations that would come within that catchment area.
So what we're about the Archdiocese?
Yeah, they'll be involved. So we're going to be talking about, for schools in this area, specifically affected by the pipeline, what's the plan? So we're getting together. It's scheduled already. It's going to be a three-hour session. Several of us at the table up here are going to be part of that. And, you know, we're being aggressive and moving forward to deal with that.
I just want to
make sure we're clear, and I'm not at this point in time. I'm reading the letter that the doctor's referring to there from the Westchester Area School District, Dr. Scanlon, referencing this emergency responders meeting that is coming up. It's an all-morning session. Update on the pipeline, communication protocol, school evacuation plans for hazardous materials, community evacuation plans, hospital capacity, et cetera. I don't know specifically that the parochial schools, the archdiocese schools, are included in this, but I certainly would like to make sure that they are. So I don't know who makes that call. Rick, whether you could find that out from Dr. Scanlon or not.
How don't you guys know that when my kid's school was 100 feet away? Why don't you check on these things?
We are checking on it. We have the letter. I'm trying to share with you what we have, and I see this from Dr. Scanlon. It's dated June 15th. It's announcing this to the emergency responders. You make a very good point. I would think that all the schools should be included, irrespective of public, private, parochial. But it's good to verify that so that they can be in touch with your school and any of the others that may not be in the immediate Westchester Area School District system. So I would think it would be inclusive. It doesn't say anything here with specificity that I'm aware of. There is a long list of who was included here, but I don't know all those individuals. So we will try and see if that can be ensured, can get assurance that that would be inclusive for schools like the parochial schools, which are so important, and, of course, in our neighborhood.
It's right by the pumping station, too. But, I mean, and I also just want to point out that this, if this, in fact, has been moving along the Mariner 1 since 2014, I feel like this is a little bit late.
Actually, I'll jump in on this real quick. I know. So we actually have a full-time safe schools coordinator in emergency management, and her main job is to ensure school safety overall, not just pipelines. But we've actually been in contact with representatives from your school that want a training around the pipeline, and we are facilitating a session directly with the school that you're referencing. So there are things in the works. They have taken a proactive approach. It's not maybe part of the meeting that was just mentioned, but her job is to reach out to all schools, public, private, charter, whatever, to make sure that they have plans and procedures in place for any hazard. So,
and what's her name?
Chrissy DiPalatonio.
Okay. And is there, will the parents be involved in this?
It's in the planning stages of how the training will be. I think initially it's for more of their staff, but I will, if I can get your information or I can exchange information with you, I can get you in touch with Chrissy, and I think it'd be a very good first step to make sure that everything that you're bringing up gets addressed thoroughly.
So, thank you.
And also I'll touch on that the West Town East Goshen Police Department also has a dedicated school resource officer, I believe is the title.
Yes.
So we'll make sure that we link up before I leave. And
the other thing that I would just add, too, is in terms of the depth of the pipeline, one thing I really didn't get into construction. We didn't get into this meeting. But most of the pipeline, and for folks that are driving along Boot Road, you'll see the drilling machines, the big machines. Mm-hmm. So in certain areas, you can drill, you dig a ditch, and you put the pipe in other areas, and a lot of it. So it's avoiding surface impact and burying the pipe deeper. Mm-hmm. So the pipe, including the area that's across the street or on the side of the street of the school, the parochial school, that's going to be buried in bedrock. And I was trying to look and see if I had an exact depth there, mm-hmm. but the depths vary. It's ballpark anywhere from 25 feet to 90 feet deep.
It's kind of hard to hear the hissing, then, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the other key point of that is in terms of an impact that mm-hmm. you likely wouldn't have an above ground impact at a site like that.
Gotcha. All right. Well. Thank you again for everything that you guys do. I appreciate it.
Jerry O'Brien from 1377 Springton Lane in Hershey Mill. My question is about the response people that Sunoco was talking about, where they are located. Are they in Reading, as you were discussing, or Harrisburg, or where, and how quickly can they get to the area?
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jerry. Our main control center is in Reading, Pennsylvania. Those are the guys who work behind the screens. They don't respond. They react, but they don't respond. Our main office, main maintenance office, is in right behind Philadelphia International Airport. We have pipeline of vehicles on the road all the time. They start there in the morning and end there at the end of the day. We have a boot station. We have our pipeliners in and out of all day that just keep an eye on the place. That's where they kind of house. That's where they have their lunch. And so we have probably 8 to 10 vehicles all around the place from Philadelphia out to halfway to Montello. So we always have people close by, but I can't say they're right there or right here all the time. But as soon as they get a call, they go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Christina Zettner, 1530 Allison Drive. I'm going to start. Mr. McGinn, Marty Shane said that your title was a customer service representative, but what really is your title, please?
Senior Director of Public Affairs.
Public Relations, that's your department?
Public Affairs, Community Affairs.
Okay, I'm going to disregard the question then that I had for you. Thank you. I will move on to my other question. It was actually in pertaining to the schools, but this other woman seemed to cover a lot of them. I will tell you, Mr. Turner, I have actually been trying to get from Westchester Area School District a copy of the emergency preparedness and evacuation plan for a number of weeks. They cannot produce it. Dr. Scanlon did write to me directly. He said that they were going to be working on the pipeline update, just like you said as well. But just as she stated, since Mariner East 1 has been flowing these NGLs for quite a while, I am quite surprised that this was not already in place. I am a resident here, of course, but I, as a parent, am very interested in being updated and involved and knowing exactly what the plan is going to be for the students. I want to know who is going to be making that decision, which could be a life and death decision between evacuation and shelter in place. I want to know what their credentials are to make that decision. And even though it was stated before, I do want to know where they will be taken. I have a lot of questions, and I hope that this is just the first of meetings with the schools that will be taking place. I hope that there is a very aggressive outreach and education with the parents so that we know what to do, because I can tell you right now I am completely in the dark. If there is an evacuation siren or something that goes off,
I'm under the impression right now that I should walk from my house to the school to collect my child, and I don't think that that's what the procedure is that you want. So I have listened to the 911 San Bruno tapes, and it was utter chaos. People were calling and saying that they had heard an explosion, but they could not give an exact location of where the emergency was. So this great plan of call, respond, size up the incident, establish a command, I don't think that's going to work if people can't tell you exactly where the location is of this leak or this explosion. And Marty, it was good of you to call and report the bubbling gas that you saw, but you probably would be taken out when a car drives past you.
Could I address that for a second?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
I understand your position. I respect that. On what I was telling you about our control center, our control room that has the monitoring pressure
right.
flows.
Yes.
Again, not to bore the details, but that leak detection system isolates the line segment, no matter how long, say it's 100 miles. Mm-hmm. And so when it picks up things based on where the most recent pressure transmitter is, so you have your beginning and your end. So those things are always reading into the control center every 10 seconds and into that computer, not a human being, into the computer. So, and I've experienced it with these gentlemen. When they send us out, they just don't say, we'll take your people out and travel the line from mile marker 0 to mile marker 100 or 200 or 300. They give us ballpark areas because, believe it or not, that's where the pressure deviation was found.
But it's also my understanding that in a number of cases, your own detection systems were not the first ones to detect the systems. It was actually landowners or it was an incident itself that took place. Correct?
Absolutely correct. That happens. Absolutely.
And the key difference in that is not a scenario that you describe. As I tried to explain, if you have a catastrophic failure or a rupture, the systems are going to detect that. If you have a scenario that I described before as a pinhole leak, one, the risk and the impact is much different. So described in that one in terms of from the LEL reading, essentially the reading of flammability, it was below the lower flammability limit. So as you build that risk in planning, you know, the scale goes up for the bigger the incidents in terms of the additional mitigation factors that you put in.
Understood. Thank you.
With regard to the evacuation plan, the one thing that we've all been emphasizing here is all hazards planning. We have been planning for evacuations for a variety of hazards for decades. So the only thing that we're trying to specialize this time is any unique features that are unique to a pipeline emergency. That's one of the reasons I believe that Dr. Scanlon wants to hold that meeting, is because they want to make sure that all of our plans are up to date and that everybody has an understanding of what's going to occur. With regard to getting details on that, 9/11 has taught us that we put too much information out there for people to get. For years, you could go and you could get the floor plans for schools. You can no longer get that online because we were giving a blueprint to people to how to create more disasters and more tragedies. Oh. So I don't know if Dr. Scanlon will share much information with you, but that's one of the reasons why we don't publicize a lot of details.
Well, the written policy that he sent me, the policy for the guidelines for the development of it, and it says that it is available. But mm-hmm. I think a parent should be able to know what the procedure is for the protection of their child. I'll just say one other thing. I totally appreciate all of your efforts here. I think East Goshen has a unique situation. We have no sidewalks here, so the evacuation routes that people are going to be taking are the roads. And any cars that are on the roads will then be immobilized. I don't know how your emergency vehicles are going to be able to easily get in and out when you have people and cars on the roads, where you have men, women, children, pets, cars, vehicles there. How you're going to get in and out, I just don't know logistically how it's going to happen.
Hello. Mary McCluskey, 1727 Clock Tower Drive, and I am Marty Shane's new best friend. Hi, Marty. Okay, I have a question for the gentleman from Sunoco. You stated that the pipeline monitoring will be done by computer. Therefore, it's automated, and valves will automatically shut down if it senses different temperature and pressure levels? Okay. So if that's the case, can it be, can you have a manual override? Can it be hacked? And if it's automatically going to regulate that, why did it fail to pick up the leak out in Morgantown, and instead that leak was found by a resident?
So a couple pieces to it. One that addresses and gets it in detail in terms of our system and information. So, West Goshen Township had hired AccuFax in terms of as a third-party expert to go in and look through essentially all our safety systems. They looked at it, and the gentleman that did the report, his name was Richard Kupowitz, but he's part of AccuFax. And we have copies and certainly can make them available. I think they're online in a number of locations, and including the township website. But he looked at the information, and we shared a bunch of information with him and looked at what are the regulations as well as what are his best practices. So a couple of things, and just to highlight it and getting into your answer to your question. So he talked about leak detection, which we talked about. The other thing that's key is two pieces. One, a line like ours flows continuously. So lines that operate that way, the readings and the data you get are much better than lines that will be operated sporadically. The other piece is in terms of the automated shutoff valves, the volume that we have them exceeding the regulation, as well as we talked about the essentially what the computers can do. But another piece that was highlighted in there is the control room operator, right? Because obviously technology is great; it does a lot. But there's folks that are well trained in the operation center that Charlie used to directly manage and work in, and they have the ability to shut off the system themselves. They don't have to go to Charlie or go to one of his designees and say, we see an issue, can we shut it off?
As a manual override.
So they have the ability to just shut in and say, let's shut down the mm-hmm. system. And then that whole process, that whole process starts that way as well, or has the ability to.
The other part I wanted to add was cybersecurity
is
big in this day and age.
Right.
Our IT system, RT group, mm-hmm. has firewalls. I don't know the details of it, but that's certainly a grave concern of ours in general. Anybody hacking in, we were putting together a procedure for how to react to something like that when it happens. But we do have the group. They monitor that very carefully, access to it. There's nobody. It's number of firewalls. Nobody could dial in and look at it however, internet in, whatever you want to call it. So, yes, we do have some cybersecurity.
It's a closed-loop system.
So the second part of my question, how did this superb system fail?
So to your point in terms of the leak, what I was trying to say is there's levels of risk. So while you have those monitors that are checking, again, the pressure, temperature, and flow, the biggest concern and where the level of automation increases is like what we talked about, a catastrophic release or a rupture, so the line breaking, right? So you'll have a loss of pressure pretty quickly. And something that's a pinhole leak and where you balance the detection because, technology is only so smart, in an incident like that where essentially you did not have a public safety threat. It was below, as I tried to mention, below the level of lower flammability level. So it wouldn't even, so what that means is if you, gasoline, anything that can combust, sometimes you can light a match and it won't light immediately or it'll extinguish. So that's the way it is with anything that can ignite, any propane, ethane,
right.
Whatever. So it was below that level.
Should we test it that way? Or?
No. So what you come out with, just trying to give an example,
okay.
But essentially that's where you have the detectors that Charlie talked about. So they go out, they get a reading, they understand, they talk about it in parts per million and what then the risk is.
Right, but it
So
but
in
it
terms
didn't
of the detection, so the detection isn't based on, isn't set to address that issue because, again, you don't have the same level of risk for individuals or persons because it can't essentially light on fire at that level. I don't know if you can explain
well,
it better.
Let me just jump in back to your question. And if I'm getting too detailed, just tell me. I wouldn't call it superb. It's really a good advanced leak detection system.
It has a lot of levels of calculation.
It needs to be superb.
Well,
this
I know.
This is a heavily
I know,
dense
I understand,
population.
But, I just want to answer your question, if I may. I'm not in there anymore. It's certainly something I could look into for you. But what I was telling you is the real small pinholes that Joe's referencing on the low side, those things start to add up over time. It takes time for that system to catch that because it's such a long mile system. And that comes up and goes to levels. I mentioned it earlier about levels of alarms, level of notification. So that's why we say, well, why didn't that thing catch that? That was probably in its early stages. It must have just started. We don't know exactly when, but it wasn't long-lasting. So what I'm saying is, say that that gentleman didn't find it, okay? Eventually, that system is going to start. It's actually a quadrant system, and it starts layering what it sees and raising the level of concern. Eventually, that would have showed up. I can't tell you when. I'm not the expert on it, but eventually it would.
I think the bottom line for me is that your answer doesn't really make me feel safe. And I think that there is a 0% that there will never be a rupture, a pinhole leak. I really think that this area needs to be very prepared for a pipeline that I think is going to take lives eventually. Maybe, and I heard you say it only, you know, you only had a few deaths. Well, to me, one East Goshen death is unacceptable. And it's not something that we have chosen to live with. We don't get anything out of this. Only you do. And we assume all the risk. We assume all of the risk. You guys represent a company that's a corporate entity that uses our natural resources. And I understand you have to speak for Sunoco, but all these other people up front have had to deal with all of these people going forward. And I don't feel safe. I don't think that it's going to be a positive experience, and we all have to be prepared. And I'm disappointed. Shame on Sunoco. I think it's corporate greed.
Hi, Linda Polishuk, 1424 Grand Oak Lane. What's not being addressed is that there is no authority given to any agency by the federal or state government to regulate where these pipelines go. There's more concern given to wetlands than there is to people's lives and property. I went into the statutes of the PUC and the pipeline for hazardous material, and all they talk about is the construction of the pipelines and the maintenance. So given that no one is able to say these pipelines should not go in a highly densely populated area, if they do, they should have a certain setback. That seems to be where everything originates. And I'm wondering why the supervisors have not written to the governor asking asking that this that the legislature be get involved in oversight. And perhaps a moratorium should be placed on further construction until a risk assessment has been conducted and it's been determined that this is not appropriate, given that Sunoco has gotten all our liquid natural gas is free, no extraction cost. I don't think it's a question as to whether they could pay to have the pipelines rerouted. I don't think that's out of line. And I think it's ingenuous for you to suggest that these pipelines are just like any other ones. No, these natural liquid gases have an explosive energy five times what a natural gas line has. That's all. Thank you.
So a couple. Go ahead, Ryan.
Let me answer the question. I think I understand it, Linda, about what we've done and what we haven't done. I myself have contacted legislators about a couple of things. One is siting, and one is we don't have any skin in the game. Why don't we get some compensation for the disruption that's going on in East Goshen Township?
We don't get any money or anything.
We don't get anything for the disruption that we've had. Now, up in the northern part of the state, they get paid. The townships get paid out of Act 13. Now, we get some money, but it's not very much, and it goes to the county. There's an association of township supervisors that's also working on the same problem. You have to understand, if the legislators don't want to change something, you and I and everybody else in this room can go marching up there, and they're not going to change it. Now, the problem is that when you go up to probably two-thirds of the state, they think that the use of natural gas, the exploration of natural gas, is a wonderful thing. Now, the problem is it's there, and where it wants to get to is down on the river. So the problem is that somehow it has to get through here.
Okay, excuse me. It's not natural gas. It's these liquids.
Yeah, well, they're a byproduct of natural gas exploration. Yeah. Well, there was hearings before the PUC, but that's another matter. I mean, it was way back 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago. There was hearings before the PUC because they had to file a petition to do all this, and then there was all kinds of things that happened. The simple fact of the matter, it's very difficult to get legislation around pipelines changed in Harrisburg because there's so many different interests in that benefit from it, that they override the ones like us that are down here that are just the receivers of the pipelines. So we keep diligently, and I'm not talking about just myself, there's others on the board that do the same thing. We keep plugging away at this, and sooner or later we might win. We've already talked to Carolyn Commit about it. Tommy Killian's already been working on it to begin with, but it's a tough, it is really a tough slog.
What about the governor?
Pardon me?
The governor?
Well, the governor's in favor of the pipelines because it creates jobs.
About 2 weeks ago, we had, thanks to Representative Comita, who hosted a meeting right here. She hosted it with a panel that included a staffer from the governor's office. Now, Linda, if you were here, you heard what I heard from that staff member. And I referred to it as a happy time Toy Town newspaper smile and nothing much else from that individual. He came unprepared to answer questions. In addition, the PUC, which is our only opportunity for real input at the state level, they didn't have the decency to send a representative here to that meeting. In disrespect to the representative and in disrespect to you and all of us, we have sent letters to Senator Toomey, Senator Casey, to Representative Costello. We have not had responses from any of them yet. The governor knows what's going on down here. I don't care, Republican or Democrat. Couldn't care less. We all could care less. We just want things properly addressed. Now, the governor knows what's going on in the Marcellus Shale territory, and the governor knows what is going on in the transmission territory where we're the recipients. As hosts, as Marty Shane said, we get nothing. And the township got nothing and gets nothing down here for that. The intractability of the legislature in Harrisburg to cooperate, to share the wealth and the risk through wealth sharing down here so that we can properly prepare is abysmal, and we're all frustrated with it. I don't know how to fracture that fractured system, to break into it to get something done. Representative Kmita, as a freshman representative, is trying. Senator Killian is trying. Senator Dinneman in a different district is trying. But as Mr. Shane said, there is a lot of different perspectives between here and Pittsburgh. In a derogatory way, some people refer to it as Pennsyltucky. That's not a nice thing to say, but there are different perspectives. You might call them rural, you may call them opportunistic, but they have a different perspective in those locations. Their environment may be suffering, but their pocketbooks, which have never been full, are now feeling the jingle, and there are a lot of people that accept it. We're not happy with it here. We're not happy with it. We didn't invite this here. Now, I want to say something else. The easements that are here where these pipelines are located, we talk about who cited them, who approved them to go there. Those easements have been in place for 75, 80 years. And what needs to occur at the federal level is to examine these easements, these documents. The federal government, like a lot of governments, has one of the most onerous tools ever, and that's eminent domain. But they also, if they have that power, they have the power to go back and review these easements in the context of today's environment and land use to see whether or not they are obsolete relative to where these industrial product transmission lines are going. And we all agree they shouldn't be going here. But it's a very, very tough situation to change. And it's not going to take just a meeting here. It's not going to take 2 months. It's not going to take 2 years. It's going to take continual public input at the grassroots level, organized. The public, they all rely on a short public memory. I don't think it's going to happen in East Goshen, but I don't know where else it's going to continue. But the voice may get heard by the governor, but the governor's also working with a fractured House and Senate. It's very frustrating. Mr. Shane has put in tons of time trying to make some inroads. We're going to be interested to see, and we will publish the responses we would get. I assume that they're only going to be a letter response from Senator Toomey and Senator Casey's office as to where they stand on this, and what their interests are relative to us and what we care about. So if you sense that I'm engaged and a little animated, so are my fellow supervisors, because we're one of you. We live in houses, too. I live 200 feet from a pipeline. I'm frustrated with it, too. I feel impotent. I feel very much neutered by our inability at local government to have much of any say except to be able to share with you and try and make a few calls and letters to the people where the decisions really are made. About all I have to say on that.
And I'd like to mention, I would also like to mention that the state is trying to take more powers away from the townships. We should be getting more. Exactly what Mike said. I'm 60, 70 feet from the pipeline. I got grandkids every day, so I know what you're talking about. We didn't do this. We're trying to make it work the best we can. If you think this was our decision, let's bring down a pipeline down 352. I don't care how you think, but we're not morons. We have to all work together on this and do everything that we're trying to do.
Can the supervisors work with other townships to get a coalition to be more, have more clout with the state or federal? Can the township work with other townships and counties to get more clout at the? No, with other in the.
John Snyder, 255 Chatham in Hershey's Mill. Marty asked a pretty direct question of the Sunoco representatives, but I didn't hear an answer. And the question, as I remember it, was take the range of possible incidents from pinhole through rupture, and I think Marty outlined four stages in between. What are the probabilities of each of those events?
Yeah. That's what I said.
Yeah.
You stated it well, John.
Like what happened at Morgantown?
No.
No. I'm just going to say that was the small version. In other words, a pinhole.
Right. What? Start there.
Okay.
What's the probability of a pinhole leak?
I don't have the percentage. I don't know if we looked at it to say, but it's very small in my mind because we don't have a lot of them. And if you move up to catastrophic failure, a rupture, same thing with our pipelines, what we've been operating under the same integrity plan for years. The worst case would be if somebody hits you. And that's why we do the aero patrols, the walks, the drags. Pipeliners drag the intersections, walk the line on occasion, plus the 24/7 monitoring in the control center.
So you're saying that you're not required to, and you have not done, any probability analysis for the various types of incidents that can occur. Mile, per pipeline, per year, however you want to measure it, you don't do that analysis?
So we look at the analysis and then we mitigate risk. So there's a number of things that we do to mitigate.
Well, what does the analysis tell you?
So what an analysis says is in terms of...
No, what are the numbers?
So I don't have the numbers. I don't have that.
The numbers exist, but you don't have them.
So what I can say, and going back in terms of probability, is getting to the kind of one of the first parts I said, in terms of the safety of pipelines overall and, you know, the delivery rate in terms of pipelines.
I understand all that. Marty asked a specific question. I'm trying to get an answer to his question. And you're telling me the numbers exist, but you don't have them here tonight.
I'm saying I don't have those numbers.
Okay.
That's what I'm
saying. Can you provide them?
I will look into it.
John, we didn't come prepared to that. I didn't, honestly. I thought we were just going to talk about the emergency responders. But that's a valid question. Let us take it back. We'll bring it to the township. And we'll share it with them, and I'm sure they'll share it with you. But we don't have them here now. So.
Yeah, John, I think the people want to hear from us the same thing we want to hear from them, and that is the way it is. That question, I've asked that question a lot.
I know you have.
And I've asked it again. And in fairness to Joe, I told him that when he decided to come. I said, this is a question that you have to answer. Because everything that anybody has said tonight, at the end of the day, they don't understand that the fact that the probability in some of these cases is so high, it will never happen. Now, and in other cases, it's very likely to happen, but they don't share that information. So as a consequence, everybody is making their own decisions. Some are, you know, confident people say, ah. Other people say, wait a minute. The East Goshen is going to blow up. So until you know what the risks are and what the consequences are, risk being probabilities or chances, it's a conversation that's impossible to have.
Well, I agree with you, Marty. That's why I re-asked.
I know, and I appreciate you saying that, but so, maybe they'll get it for us.
Well, let me answer in a different way because I tried to answer it directly. So in terms of probabilities, in terms of different incidents, right, for fatalities and pulling numbers off, so you've got anything from, including the insurance, and this is citing insurance and actuarial institutes that look at fatalities and what your probability is of it. So in two parts, how many deaths or fatalities it would be, right? So as I mentioned, for natural gas liquids pipelines across the country, there's been 15 fatalities over those 67,000 miles of pipeline in 20 years. So in terms of fatality, if you average it out, I think it's 0.75. When you look at deaths in other scenarios, whether it's fire or smoke, 2,701, and this is citing 2014, poisoning, 42,000, motor vehicle, 35,000, firearms, 11,000. with probabilities of 1 in 96, 1 in 114, 1 in 370. And in terms of a pipeline, while I don't have that specific one, it's orders of magnitude higher. So I don't have, to your point, in terms of trying to I guess, compare, that's what I'm trying to do, but I don't have a specific number that
well,
I can provide.
I'm just asking you follow up by providing the numbers. One other question. What percentage of the product flowing through the Mariner East 2 lines will be used by customers in Pennsylvania?
Sure. So you have another number, and I know you're not going to like this answer, but it varies. It's going to vary seasonally as well. So in terms of butane, as markets, right, because we're moving commodities, in the 6 months, in the winter months, just about all of the butane demand, it's locally, because I said about 10% of your gasoline that's blended in is butane. So, and when I say locally, I include not just Pennsylvania, but considering we are in the tri-state area, some of this product will go into states like New Jersey and Delaware. So just putting it in context. But essentially all of it at that time. And in the summer months, we are, what they say, long on butane. So some of it, you'll have some that moves around. Same thing for propane. You have a significant amount of propane demand in the winter months, the colder months, because of home heating. And in the summer months, there's less of it. And the product starts to move.
So you're, in terms of the, you're and, telling us here tonight that the Mariner East 2 pipeline will be providing propane for Pennsylvania residents' heating demands.
Correct. Mariner East 1 already does.
I know that, but...
And Mariner East 2 can as well, yes.
It can, but
it will.
Will it?
It will. It will. We have offtake points, to your point, and we've highlighted the mapping in Berks and Lebanon County, among other locations.
Carolyn Lachlan Horkus, 1601 Glenmont Lane East. Obviously, there's a lot here that we've heard as residents of this township that we cannot control. My house is less than 100 feet from the pipeline. I appreciate the global emergency plans that you've laid out and shared with us and the details as much as you've given to us about that. But as an individual in a situation, if I'm at home or if I'm at work and my child is at home, how are we going to be notified that there is something happening and being told what we do in that situation if we stay put? I mean, has there been any discussion or consideration of notifying people within a certain distance of the pipeline that live within a certain distance of the protocol if an accident, if a rupture, if a leak or something like that were to happen, so that we know in that instance, what do we do? Do I tell my son to stay in the house? Do I tell him to go, you know, that way? What do I do?
Yeah, so the answer to your question is yes, those procedures and systems to do so do exist. And the big one being that I touched on, Ready Chesco. As I mentioned before, you know, only 9% of East Goshen residents are signed up for this. We can't force people to sign up for our platform. It'd be great if we could, because in an ideal world, we would have everybody on there. But if we can't get people to sign up for it, we can't get that information out that you're talking about, you know, is a piece of it. And if there were a true life-threatening situation, that would be one platform, yes, we would use. But with the enrollment numbers low, not just in East Goshen, but countywide, it's a struggle of ours that we have this wonderful platform that we're going to be pushing this information out of, and we can't get people to sign up for it. Whether it's for pipeline information or a flood or a tornado, or a community event that there's going to be a fair next weekend, we just can't get people to sign up to it. No, so you would sign up to basically and register your devices, your home phone, any email that you have, and any cellular device that you may have. And
then we would check that to find out what to do.
No, it's going to come over it.
It's going to come over as a text, an email, or a phone call.
It gives the alert. It doesn't give us a plan.
Well, right. That's my point. It doesn't...
It doesn't give you the plan.
It doesn't give you the plan. I mean, it's not... Right. It's not saying, okay, you are this distance from what has been determined to be an incident, and this is what you should do.
So there's a couple different things here. The reference in the back to the tornado warning is another big piece of what we do is we try to get out preparedness for, again, I know you've heard it all night, but all hazards. you know, it's expected that you, just as you're taking the time to be prepared for a pipeline emergency, that you understand that if there's a tornado or a flood, that you have general awareness for you and your family of what to do in an emergency. We try so hard to get that information out, and we go out and we push out and we hand out pamphlets, and the reality is nobody takes it seriously, unfortunately, until, you know, they either live through it or it's knocking on their front door. And it's something that we challenge with, but we really do try to get the messaging out. And, you know, when there is something that needs immediate action or instructions to the public, it's going to be in that message. We're not just going to tell you, hey, you know what, there's been a leak, good luck. You know, it's not going to be that message. It's going to be detailed information that you're going to be able to act upon and make a decision for you and your family and whoever you may be responsible for. And
I can't imagine that there's not some way you couldn't put a card in everybody's mailbox and say, sign here to get on this system.
We've tried. We've
ma'am,
tried with the
ma'am, as a supervisor in East Goshen and my other four board members, every meeting one of us will say how many in the room, which are normally three or four people, are signed up for constant contact. That's just us. And now you've got the county program. It's put out in so many different revenues. The police put it out. EMS puts it out. We put it out. To send out a postcard, I have to tell you, ma'am, half of my mail, unless it says Bill, like Bill, I throw it away. I don't read mail anymore. If it's important, it's going to come over my text. For them to send out mail cards, half of them would be thrown away.
I think this crowd tonight was largely because you publicized the fact that if there was going to be this meeting, you did send out cards. We got it in our mailbox, and we said, huh, this looks important. Mm-hmm.
And as another gentleman said earlier, you know, the township makes a great effort to send notifications of variances and meetings about things and stuff like that. I would specifically like to suggest to you, to people who are, not that no life is, you know, every single life here is important, of course, but people that are within a very close range of this pipeline and at much greater risk than somebody who's, you know, 2-5 miles away from it, be notified by mail that information will be forthcoming as to signing up for this. I wasn't aware of it, and that's partially my fault, but I will sign up for that. But to make the people that are in the most dangerous areas aware of an emergency plan that they can utilize as a citizen in their home, not somebody in a school or in Wellington or something like that where you have an established, well-organized plan, but somebody who's, my son may be in the basement, and he may not have his cell phone with him. I may not be able to reach him. How does he know what to do? You know, if we have that information, then we can provide that and he can be aware of it. And I think that, I would like to suggest that that consideration be made by the township, that the people that are in the closest range of this pipeline be given more information about protecting themselves and their families.
And I will just touch on real quick that there are other platforms that I hinted at earlier that allow us to mass notify in extreme situations, such as an evacuation that you don't enroll for, that basically would take over if you ever gotten an Amber Alert on your cell phone. Newer technology allows us to basically target an area and notify cell phones. And also through the reverse 911. If you have a registered landline, whether you signed up for this or not, we have you in a system that we can reverse call you on. And to your point, ma'am, there are cards that have instructions on how to sign up for Ready Chesco. In the back of the room, they're gone? Okay. So if Eric gives me 1 second here, the website is readychesco.org. It's readychesco.org. I have one left for you. I'll give you. Actually, I got two more up here. I should have brought more. I do apologize, but I'll be here afterwards to get out as many as I can. So,
thank you.
If I could just add one other thing, I know we're here to talk about pipelines, and a number of people have mentioned weather events and notifications. Just to show you some of the innovative approaches Chester County has been using for a number of years, the National Weather Service from Mount Holly, New Jersey, can see Chester County to predict events. Unfortunately, they can see Chester County at 11,000 feet. So a number of years ago, we planted more than a dozen weather stations in Chester County that immediately can feed to the 911 center as well as to the National Weather Service, so we have the detailed information we need. So there's a lot of systems in place. You'd be amazed the amount of systems they put in place to help protect the public in Chester County.
My name is Carl Horkus. My address is 1601 East Glenmont Lane. First, I have two questions. Number one, I was talking to one of the workmen the other day, and they said you already have a leak on 352. Is that true? Yes or no?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. The pipeline isn't in service.
No, another leak.
So, you mean in the acting pipeline? No.
Yeah.
A blowout of some stuff.
Are you talking what we call the clay? So
it
where we're drilling?
It was a clay. The stuff.
So yeah,
the bentonite.
Right. The bentonite. Okay. All right. I understand your question now. So, for any of the areas where the drill machines are, they drill a hole, they go underground. So the essentially they use water and drilling mud called bentonite. Okay. So it's a clay mud. I can show you after. Kind of what it looks like. You know, it's got little pieces of stone in it. It's inert. It's the same stuff you would use for a water well. So what can happen when you're drilling a well is they call it an inadvertent return. So there's natural fissures underground at times that you can hit, and with the pressure, you'll have the system flows in a cycle, so it's supposed to flow back to the drill. So again, if it doesn't all flow back, you have an area. So it was along 352. It was contained. Worked directly with the property owner there. And we haven't had a repeat incident.
Now, when you get to Rocky Hill and go through the bedrock, how much radon is going to be released through the fissures? So, I mean, is that because I've been told that happens also?
So everything in terms of the testing we do in preparing for the drills, all of it is reviewed and all of it is made sure that. There isn't an issue. There isn't a radon issue or some other issue.
How did you do that?
Essentially, we hire geologists to determine. They do. I forget the term that they're used, but they'll do test bores.
Test wells.
You could see it at times where they'll come in.
So
do
when
a sample.
I put a radon thing in my basement, I can be sure that there's not going to be an elevation when you go through the bedrock. You're going to guarantee me that?
What I'm going to say is that through testing and everything, there wouldn't be an impact. Now, I know overall in this area, I live not too far away, and I have a radon detector in my basement, so I'm not going to say that there isn't naturally occurring radon where some folks need that. But what I'm saying is, in terms of the geologists and the testing that we did, that should not be an impact because of the construction.
Okay. So my last question is, this gas can be ignited by a car, by an ignition of a car?
It could.
Yeah, so you have this pipeline going all along these big roads, and how many thousands of cars are going up and down? So you have a leak overnight, and it goes down into one of the valleys. When the traffic starts in the morning, what do we have?
So in addition, in terms of any leak that you would have, even though it's heavier than air, the gas essentially dissipates over time. So with wind direction, with momentum, it can. And you have, I was trying to use the term, like flammability or explosive level. And I don't know, Charlie, if you want to jump
upper
in.
And lower
upper
explosive
lower
limits.
Yeah. So over time, and depending on the concentration, it's no longer ignitable. That was what I was doing a bad job trying to explain to one of your fellow citizens.
All right. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is David Kohler. I live at 1750 Hunter's Circle. And I want to state I couldn't agree more with Mike Lynch and what he told us about our state legislature. I'm a captain, U.S. Navy retired, and I was a Navy SEAL for 26 years. And the only reason I'm saying that is because... Thank you, but that's not the reason why I mentioned that. I grew up in a culture where it's very important to do prudent preventive planning to mitigate risk, because we go in harm's way lots of times to defend our nation. And I think it's very important that we do prudent preventive planning for this situation that we're in right now. I personally think we've all been naive in getting to the situation that we are in now, and having it occur the way it has occurred. But here we are, we're in this situation. We have to do whatever we can to make things as better as we can make them. I'm glad to know that we do have representatives here from Senator Killian's office and Representative Committee's office. And the comment that I'm going to make is kind of directed not necessarily to them specifically, but to our legislatures in general. I got to say, as a former military person who's defended this country, I'm ashamed of our Pennsylvania government. We supposedly have the second highest paid legislators in the nation, and I don't understand what they're doing for the public good as regards the oil and gas extractors that are in our state. We need to start charging a severance tax. Why we aren't charging the same severance tax that every single other state that has gas, natural gas, and oil is totally beyond me. I just can't quite understand it. And by not doing so, we've kind of allowed Pennsylvania to be treated like a third world country by the oil and gas extractors. We're basically here to be exploited for a personal profit of a corporation, and us as the public aren't really gaining a thing from it. Basically to it, I lost the power, but I can talk loud. Basically, to allow this to happen by our legislation, by our legislators, is irresponsible, in my opinion. If we did charge a severance tax, it would be a moral and it would be a legal state income that we could use to pay for better training and better equipment for our emergency responders, which they have already stated that they could always use. We could use it to pay for our infrastructure and our roads, and we can use it to pay for our public transportation. But we don't do it, and I don't know why we don't. I think that it's a responsibility of all of us to demand that our publicly elected officials, our state senators and our state representatives, do everything they can to push so that we at least charge the extractors that come in here the same tax that they would be being charged in any other state where they were doing the extracting the natural gas and the oil. It's the right thing to do, and to allow the oil and gas extractors, whether it's Sunoco or whether it's somebody else, to profit personally through exploiting the natural resources of our state and us not getting anything for it, and then not being held responsible to pay in advance for potential problems that might be caused or emergencies that might be caused, is just totally irresponsible. I'll just leave it with that. I think it's incumbent upon all of us to constantly let our legislators know what our feelings are and the fact that they need to do the right thing, they need to step up, and they need to at least... We're not punishing the oil companies. We're just charging them the same fee that every other state, and probably a lot of the drillers that have come in to Pennsylvania have come from those states. So we're creating jobs for people from other states. We need to charge an adequate severance tax for the inconvenience and the exploitation that we're going through. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Pam Onyx from 657 Heatherton in Hershey's Mill. My first question comment is from my husband, who's a retired naval commander. His question was, why did they have to put an NGL pier 1.4 miles out into the Chesapeake Bay, away from houses and towns, et cetera? I think we know the answer, but there's the question. the pier where the NGLs are going to be delivered into the Chesapeake Bay. I believe it's 1.4 miles out.
I think we're talking two different things. You may be referring to Cove Point. That's the only one I know in the Chesapeake, which is liquefied natural gas.
Okay.
It's a different product. So,
okay.
You know, the piers where this is delivered and where ships are in Marcusook are the same kind of piers that you would load any of our products at. And they're
okay.
Not at that kind of level.
Okay, I guess he did say LNG, so I guess I'm incorrect there. My other question is, are there any devices available that can measure leaks above ground that could be purchased or used to detect leaks beyond the detection process that's already in place? Perhaps, or... whatever. I just want to know if there is anything reliable that's available.
I'm just trying to prime a pump here, but I believe that they said they have leak detectors. If you put them out there, they would tell you if there's a leak or not. Now, there's not going to be somebody that walks up and down the street all day long, determining whether there's a leak or not. But yes, there are leak detectors that would show whether you had a leak or not have a leak.
Well, it might be worth then us as community members to get
you,
more information.
Did you have
that.
A follow-up to that? Like, okay, if there is one, what do you recommend that we do with it?
I would just like to first have the information, and then perhaps as community we would want to get some of those or have them provided. Thank you. Well, yes, I know. I agree, but I was kind of...
Hi. Good evening, Tom Ayer, 1216 Upton Circle. My question is just for clarification. The boot road, I know that you said it's a pumping station, but is it also a shutoff valve station?
Go ahead, Charlie. It does have shutdown, or what we call emergency flow.
Okay.
It does have automatic shutoff valves. They can be shut manually. They're called EFRDs, emergency flow restriction devices.
So for the existing lines that we have, not the ones that are being built now, there's a pump station there, and they can also shut off the line there. The two new lines that we're building now, the 20 and the 16-inch, that's what I was explaining before, next to Goshen Fire Department. That's where those automated valves will go.
And they're shut-off valves?
Yeah. Any valve that's above ground, I mean, you have the purpose is to be able to shut in the system, and these are automated. So they can be operated remotely by our control room.
Okay, so the two closest shutoff valves to, like, Peter and Paul, for instance, they would be at the property next to Goshen Fire Company, and where's the other shutoff, Middletown?
No, it's in Thornbury Township, Delaware County, so it's pretty much right at the off of 926.
By Duffer's.
Duffer's,
okay.
If you know that.
So that's like 8-9 miles?
About 6 miles.
Okay. Would Sunoco be able to provide to the township the number of exact miles that is and how long it would take that line to drain, just so the public can be aware of it?
We've provided, I think, the exact miles. That it's six. I don't know offhand the kind of to the decimal point. And, you know, we've also provided in terms of how long it would take to shut them off in terms of the, you know, 30 to 90 seconds, depending on the size of the pipe.
Okay, thank you.
But we could get that for you. There's specific miles between each one.
Uh-huh.
If you have a specific one, get us the information. We'll tell you when we close those off how long would it take to purge it and get it out of there, whether you push it or you vent it. We could give you that information. You know, 20 miles or 10 miles of 8-inch pipe equals at such and such a rate.
Okay, so all three pipelines, the existing one and the two future ones, will have shutoff valves upstream from Peter and Paul by like 2,000 feet, roughly.
I don't know offhand, but yeah, we can confirm that. I know we have in the past because they've asked, but we have that information.
Okay.
I can make that readily available.
Can I ask
Thank you.
A follow-up question to those valves?
No, that's it, Marty.
Tom,
it's after 10:30. We have to go, Tom. Sorry.
You said the valves will be done. Is there a done deal with the PUC in the West Goshen issue? The settlement agreement violation?
Can't hear you, Marty.
I'm asking Mr. McGinn a question.
You can ask him afterwards if they want to stay.
No, this is important for everyone in the room.
It's important to you, but I said we have to leave at 10:30. We have to leave at 10:30. It's now 20:00.
So, and in terms of addressing it, I can address it. So, you know, we have property that we've purchased, and you know, we have the right to build the valves at that site.
No, you don't.
I think, Tom, you've litigated and had questions in terms of this point. We agree to disagree.
The settlement agreement specifically forbids
it doesn't, Tom.
No, it does. And they're
that's your opinion. It's
and
being litigated.
West
and
Ocean, the PUC, the settlement agreement terminology.
Marty.
So was a deal cut, yes or no, to allow those valves to go in?
Tom, based on the settlement agreement, our position is that the valves can go there.
No, I know,
and it's a
position.
Legal question. So that's the only answer I can give to you, Tom.
You're saying will.
Yes.
Will is a definite. Definites are set in stone. But there's an ongoing thing with the West Goshen Township and the PUC matter and the violation of
Tom,
the settlement
agreement.
This is a
legal matter for West Goshen and Sunoco. It does not involve in any way, shape, or form.
Sure it does. It absolutely does, Marty. Because the people here are asking if there's going to be shut-off safety valves or not. But that violates our agreement. Well, I'm just, look, they came here to answer questions. I was at home watching this at home, and I heard him say, will. So I came here to ask that question. And fortunately, the last gentleman asked it. No, it is, because it is relevant, Marty. It's a safety feature or not a safety feature. Okay. No. It's unfortunate. Yeah. So. I don't think I am, Mr. Lynch. You know, it's unfortunate that you guys say you're willing to talk to the community, but when they're asking hard questions, all of a sudden, you're not an expert.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Oh, boy. Always something, right?
Huh?
Always something.
Always nothing, yeah.
I understand all the concern. I don't know.
Yeah, I'll be in touch.